Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Another story now. The main reason that plans to cut costs at the Postal Service, why they got everyone's attention, the election, and concerns about mail-in voting. Well, there is another concern. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy's cost-cutting could set the stage for privatizing the Postal Service, something the Trump administration has endorsed. Unions say that could disrupt an important role the Postal Service has played, providing generations of African Americans a path into the middle class. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
In North Philadelphia, Gary Simmons is standing outside a large Postal Service mail processing facility.
I worked here for 32 years. I was a mail handler. So, this place is near and dear to my heart.
Simmons retired 3 years ago, before he turned 60. He says a career with the Postal Service helped his family have a good life.
I was able to raise them, help pay for my son's college education, provide a good middle-class lifestyle for us, and to know that I would have my retirement taken care of.
The Postal Service has long given African-American workers a place to avoid some of the discrimination that exists in the broader employment world. History professor Phil Rubio says that started just after the Civil War, when Congress passed a law that ended the whites-only hiring practice for postal jobs.
And African-Americans, starting with Union Army veterans, abolitionists, and others, began finding their way into this government job.
Rubio says the pay wasn't always good, but the job came with some prestige, and it offered security, benefits, and civil service protections that improved over the decades. Today, African Americans are 27% of the Postal Service, about twice their share of the overall workforce. Among those who say they benefited from postal careers is actor Danny Glover.
My mom and dad worked for the Postal Service for most of their working lives.
In this 2015 video, Glover says his sister and brother also worked for the agency, and he worked there as a teenager during Christmas breaks.
Working for the Postal Service enabled my parents to buy their first home.
This video was part of a campaign to protect the Postal Service from privatization. Among the advocates for that is Chris Edwards, an economist with the libertarian Cato Institute.
The postal industry is no longer any kind of natural monopoly. And when you don't have natural monopoly, I think we ought to let entrepreneurs come into this industry and show us how they can improve it.
But private sector jobs don't pay as much. Total compensation for the median Postal Service employee last year was just over $96,000. FedEx is about half that, and UPS is in the middle of the two. Privatization likely would bring downward pressure on Postal Service wages and benefits, which would hurt African Americans disproportionately. But Edwards says there's another issue of fairness here.
People paying for postal services are paying all those benefits, so it seems to me that the government should be reflective somewhat of the private sector.
Postal worker unions have been among the loudest opposition voices to privatization.
The Postal Service is not a business. It's a service. It's a service to the American people.
Judy Beard is legislative and political director at the American Postal Workers Union. She started at the Postal Service more than 50 years ago to pay her way through college. She says these jobs benefit more than black postal workers and their families.
By shopping in the community, buying gas in the community, going to church in the community, their children are going to school in the community. So all of that just raises the whole community.
Meantime, Postmaster General DeJoy has suspended budget-cutting measures put in place this summer until after November's election, but says the steps are still needed to bolster the agency's finances. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Thank you. field. Now.
What?
It's against the law, that's why. No niggas don't play with white boys. Now you get off the field or go to jail.
Hey, use that thing. You better hit me square between the
eyes. Hey, hold on now. What'd he do wrong?
We ain't having no niggers mixed with white boys in this town. Y'all ain't upstates now. They got to keep separate. The Brooklyn Dodgers ain't changing our way of living. Where y'all from anyhow?
I'm from Greenwood, Mississippi.
Hell, boy, you ought to know better. Now you tell your nigger I said to get.
So what did you do?
Oh, I said, okay, Skipper, I'm a-gettin'.
You don't want no trouble.
Yes, I did.
Last night, after the day-long protest here in Washington, D.C., word came of the tragic news that actor Chadwick Boseman had died. He was 43 years old.
Somebody sent me a text, and they said, Black Panther just died.
That's Rodney Cox. He's a school principal who traveled from Oklahoma City to attend the march.
Man, 2020 has been so rough on the culture itself for minorities. Man, we've lost so many people. And to think about when Black Panther came out, one of the first heroes that our young African-American men have had the ability to look up to. I've seen so many kids that inspired to be that. I've seen so many Black Panther costumes that gave kids hope and made them feel like they had a special ability that they often don't find in society. It hurt and touched me so much just thinking about how it's going to affect students who felt like for a moment they had that power and they were invincible. Now to be brought back down with everything else that's going on.
In 2018, Boseman had this message for students at his alma mater, Howard University.
Graduating class, hear me well on this day. This day when you have reached the hilltop and you are deciding on next jobs, next steps, careers, further education. You would rather find purpose than a job or a career. Purpose crosses disciplines. Purpose is an essential element of you. It is the reason you are on the planet at this particular time in history. Your very existence is wrapped up in the things you are here to fulfill. Whatever you choose for a career path, remember the struggles along the way are only meant to shape you for your purpose. When I dare to challenge the system that would relegate us to victims and stereotypes with no clear historical backgrounds, no hopes or talents. When I questioned that method of portrayal, a different path opened up for me. The path to my destiny.
That path brought Boseman to portray some of U.S. history's greatest change makers, Jackie Robinson in the movie 42, and a young Thurgood Marshall in the movie Marshall. I spoke with him about how he prepared for that role back in 2017. And just a warning, there's racist language in this answer.
You know, I'm from Anderson, South Carolina, but I grew up in the South. So I know what it is to ride to school and have Confederate flags flying from trucks in front of me and behind me, to see a parking lot full of people with Confederate flags and know what that means. I've been stopped by police for no reason. I've been called boy and nigger and everything else that you could imagine. Along with the great hospitality that is in the South, that is part of it. And so I understand what it is to exist in that space and find your manhood. And so I don't think that is a thing that is gone completely foreign to our existence right now. So part of my, I guess, ability to face it is because I faced it. I failed at facing it. I get the opportunity in playing the character to relive those things and do things a different way.
That was actor Chadwick Boseman speaking to us in 2017. He died yesterday from colon cancer at the age of 43.
A terrible thing to waste. Environmental racism and its assault on the American mind. Written by Harriet A. Washington.
The death toll from Hurricane Laura is now 16 people. Residents along the Gulf Coast are picking up the pieces, trying to decide how and whether to rebuild. And in some places, they're doing it in the shadow of petrochemical facilities that released enormous amounts of extra pollution because of the hurricane. NPR's Rebecca Hersher has been reporting on Hurricane Laura's connection to climate change and some of the questions that this storm raises about how we power our lives. Good morning. Good morning, Rebecca.
Hi, good morning.
So let's start with the latest. How are the industrial areas hit by Hurricane Laura faring now?
Well, the immediate acute danger seems to have passed in most places. A plant that caught fire in Louisiana is no longer burning. Environmental authorities in Texas say they dodged a bullet in terms of how much pollution was released. That's compared to past storms. But people who are returning to their homes, working outside, breathing the air, they are still breathing more pollution than normal in many places.
Now, Laura came ashore as a very powerful Category 4 hurricane. What role did climate change play in that?
Well, there was really hot water in the Gulf of Mexico, and that just provided a lot of energy for the storm. And it also got really powerful very quickly. Wind speeds almost doubled in the 24 hours right before Laura hit land. And that is something that climate scientists say is getting more common as the Earth heats up, this rapid intensification. And of course, that is bad. It's bad because there's less time to prepare if a storm gets more powerful really quickly.
That makes it difficult for those of us who live on the Gulf Coast. It gives us less time to evacuate. It also is less time for industry to prepare to shut down things and make things safe before evacuating workers, right?
Exactly. And dozens of major refineries and facilities that manufacture solvents and even the raw materials that are used to manufacture surgical masks and medical gloves, they were in the path of Hurricane Laura. So when the storm was approaching, a lot of those facilities, they shut down, as you said, for safety. But shutting down a refinery or a chemical plant, it often means releasing a lot of extra pollution. Basically, they burn off fuel and chemicals that can't safely sit inside pipes. And so, according to just the preliminary data reported by companies themselves, they released more than 4 million extra pounds of pollution even before the storm arrived.
Wow. What does that mean for the people who live near those facilities?
Well, it's really bad. All that extra pollution is bad for the health and safety of people who are already living with dirtier than average air and water, even when there isn't a storm. A lot of public health officials and climate scientists who I've spoken to in the last week, they pointed out that Hurricane Laura is a perfect example of how people who are already vulnerable are more likely to live on the front lines of climate change. Like, this is how Mustafa Ali put it. He was a longtime EPA official, now works for the National Wildlife Federation.
We have sacrifice zones across the Gulf Coast. There are communities of color and lower wealth communities that are often pushed into our most dangerous locations.
And they're dangerous because they're near industrial pollution, dangerous because they're in the path of more and more damaging hurricanes, and dangerous because of the combination of the two. When a hurricane slams into industry, like it did last week, it releases things that are just bad for people's health.
That's NPR's Rebecca Hersher. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And it was hot. It was so hot. It was like 95, 100 degrees in the shade. The wind never blew.
And they say that New Orleans has humidity down there, which kind of cools us off. That's bullshit. It was death heat.
Inside the convention center, it was so stifling hot, people tried to stay outside.
Hot as hell, 100-something degrees.
It's hot.
It was very, very hot at that time. It was 97, 98 degrees.
It was hot.
And the heat radiating off of the highway at night was intensely hot.
It's hot as hell.
That was the worst summer. I mean, that heat was ridiculous.
Man, hot as heck in here.
It was beyond Africa heat. If Africa heat was anything like that, like I said before, and I'll say it again, they keep saying go back to Africa. Hell no.
2020 is on track to be one of the hottest years on record. But the exposure to this extreme heat depends on where you live. The temperature of one neighborhood could be as much as 20 degrees hotter than another. Much like with COVID-19, communities of color are disproportionately bearing the brunt of this temperature disparity. One recent study indicates that this might be by design. Earlier this year, researchers at Portland State University and the Science Museum of Virginia linked the temperature disparities we're seeing today to racist housing policies from decades past.
And now we turn to the authors. One of the authors of that study, Vivek Shandas, is a professor of urban studies and planning at Portland State University. Vivek, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So in the study, you looked at more than 100 cities in the U.S. What's the degree of difference in terms of temperature between black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods?
So across the country, we surveyed about 108 cities, and systematically we were finding that there was a pattern of about 5 degrees difference in terms of Fahrenheit that's averaged across the entire country. And in some cities, that difference was upwards of 13 degrees Fahrenheit. And so what we're seeing is a real disparity in terms of who's getting exposed to this extreme heat.
And are there differences that are more pronounced depending on which cities we're talking about? Like, where are certain disparities more striking from a geographic standpoint?
Right. So this is something we're still digging into. This is one of these correlative studies where we're just looking for really broad patterns. And one of the things that emerged for us immediately was that 94% of the cities that we looked at had this pattern where historically redlined areas were always hotter than their non-redlined counterparts. And so this history of disinvestment that had occurred in these redlined neighborhoods was very stark and very easy to pick up in this kind of a broad survey of cities. Geographically, we're finding that there are several cities that really ranked in the top. The city, completely coincidentally, the city that I live in, Portland, Oregon, which has, needless to say, been on the news a lot lately, ranked number one on that list. And that's where we saw the temperature difference of 13 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that really got us thinking. The next city was Denver, Colorado, then came Minneapolis, then came the usual suspects that we've heard a lot about in the news in terms of Baltimore and Jacksonville and Orlando and Chicago, as well as Philadelphia. So there are these set of cities that just followed the top three. And so we're really starting now to look into those specific cities, why they're ranking so high, what happened historically, what were some of the local policies that occurred that created this massive disparity in terms of heat.
I mean, and you're talking about disparities within the same city, right? These are neighborhoods within the same city. These aren't from city to city even.
Correct. So even within the city, we have certain areas that have had massive freeways go through, that have had large public housing complexes, that have had all the kind of permissive and undesirable land uses go to these neighborhoods that were historically redlined over the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And all those things that the wealthier, often whiter neighborhoods didn't want ended up in these neighborhoods. And that's where we're seeing a lot of this disparity.
Vivek, are there other, I want to get back to sort of how this happened, like why, what explains the heat disparities? You mentioned things like freeways, but what about things like trees?
Right. So we started, we've been conducting these campaigns where we go around and work with community organizations to go and collect temperature and humidity measurements throughout the country. And one of the things we started seeing as we were going about engaging these vast kind of cadre of volunteers to collect these temperature and humidity measurements at very fine resolution, very really granular stuff, we started seeing that the neighborhoods and the volunteers would comment to us that the neighborhoods they were driving through just had, many of them had fewer trees, had very different land uses. And so we started looking at this in relation to sociodemographics, who was living there. And we noticed that there was a very clear pattern of lack of tree cover in these locations. And so what happens is when you put a freeway down, you put a big box store down with all that asphalt parking lot, that really seals up the ground, and there's much less space for anything else that can go. And so you're kind of squeezing out trees in the sense of putting down all of this asphalt, these big box stores, these freeways. And so what now communities have to do in order to be able to cool their neighborhoods with trees is work even harder to now tear up that old asphalt, tear up that concrete. And I'm in touch with so many planners and urban foresters that are talking about how do we expand canopy in places that have so much surface ceiling of asphalt. So that's one of the biggest conundrums that we're faced with now, is that these historical planning and design policies went in place in such a way that they really make it even harder now to be able to cool those areas, as opposed to the non-redline counterparts where we can get trees in much easier today. And so we have a lot of work ahead of us.
And Vivek, I want to make sure we get this in. We've got about 2 minutes left here, but I'm curious about the health effects of heat, particularly in the communities that you're talking about. I grew up in a community such as this, and so I'm wondering, is there physical or mental health issues that happen as a result of extreme heat for people who live in these communities?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the silent and most discriminating killers that we know of at this point. It's outside of COVID, it's been one of the largest killers in terms of natural hazards that the U.S. and many places around the world face. And so what happens is it's often a heat wave comes through, which are growing also intensity, duration, and frequency around the country. It essentially affects the body through physical response. So this is your ability to thermoregulate. Once you reach that 37 Celsius or 98.6 Fahrenheit threshold and your body's not able to sweat and get that heat out, certain organs start to fail. And so what you start seeing is those that are most vulnerable, especially those that have pre-existing health conditions, which COVID and many other health conditions would challenge them to be able to come through a heat wave well. If you have pre-existing condition, if you have lack of AC or ability to run the AC, those are really, really pernicious kinds of experiences and conditions that would expand and deepen the likelihood of mortality or morbidity. So it is a very intense killer that way.
Vivek Chandas is a professor of urban studies and planning at Portland State University. Vivek, thanks for being with me.
Appreciate that. Thanks. Take care.
Johnson three. Into the arms of Davis, and the superior team all season long was the superior team tonight, and the Kentucky coronation is complete. Champions 2012.
At the University of Kentucky, a list of demands from black professors has brought new life to an old debate about the name of the school's basketball arena. Rupp Arena is named for Adolph Rupp, the famous basketball coach whose sustained success in the mid-20th century turned the program into the powerhouse it remains today. But his role in Kentucky's basketball history of segregation has some wondering if his name should be so prominent. NPR's Becky Sullivan has the story.
In 40-plus years of coaching, Adolph Rupp won more than 800 games, 4 national titles, and 5 Coach of the Year awards. Rupp Arena opened just a few years after he retired in 1972, and the Wildcats have played there ever since.
Rupp Arena, a singular college basketball cathedral that packs more than 20,000. And when
Then this summer came the letter from the African American and Africana Studies faculty. It outlines the challenges faced by black students, staff, and faculty at the University of Kentucky, and it lists 10 demands. Things like requiring that undergrads take a course on race and inequality, appointing more black faculty to leadership positions, and so on. It's the very last demand on that list that has gotten the most attention. Quote, the university should rename Rupp Arena. Derek White is a history professor who helped write the letter.
The most recognizable building on our campus, not only to people here, but across the country and even across the globe, is Rupp Arena. And Rupp, as the most powerful basketball coach in America, only coached one black player.
White says they don't want to erase every mention of Adolph Rupp. But his name, the letter says, has, quote, come to stand for racism and exclusion. It's a striking ask because Kentucky basketball is so big and because it has no bigger name than Adolph Rupp.
Rupp was the man who built Kentucky basketball into sort of an iconic program.
That's Dick Gabriel, a longtime Kentucky sports broadcaster.
And at the time he retired, was the winningest coach in college basketball. But he was, and still is, criticized for not recruiting African Americans until the last couple of years of his career.
Like many sports, college basketball began to integrate in earnest in the years after World War II. Indiana played its first black player in 1947, Kansas in 1951. Before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, he played basketball at UCLA. And by the 1960s, schools across the country were recruiting and winning titles with black players. In the South, segregation held on. But even there, under pressure from the federal government and pressure to win, teams began to integrate in the mid-60s, including peer schools like Louisville and North Carolina. Gabriel says Rupp didn't play his first and only black player until 1970, in his second to last year before retirement.
Rupp developed a reputation as someone who did not want black players on his team. Fairly or unfairly, that was the knock on Adolph Rupp.
The demand to change the arena's name has a lot of opponents, Kentucky fans and some people who knew Rupp, who point out some other facts about him. That he did try to recruit several black players over the course of the 1960s, that he asked ushers to remove fans who yelled racial slurs, that he was willing to play against integrated teams when some other Southern schools would not. Those things were highlighted in a documentary about Rupp produced by Dick Gabriel back in 2005. Gabriel doesn't have an opinion on the name change, but he did say that as a kid growing up in Kentucky, he'd had this idea that Rupp was an avowed racist. But his research showed him it's more complicated than that.
I had to do a complete 180 on my opinion that Rupp was indeed a segregationist. I came to realize he was not. But that's what makes it so confusing, is that he was active in trying to sign black players. And yet, on the other hand, it's been documented that he had used inappropriate language.
It's partly this murky picture of Rupp that has dampened debate in Lexington, a progressive college town that a few years back removed two Confederate statues just blocks from the arena. Among students on campus, there isn't a huge clamor to change the name, says Chandler Wilcox, a sophomore who is white. But most of his classmates, he says, are willing to do what he calls listening and learning.
Basically, like, let's do the research. Let's figure out, looking back, is there enough evidence to prove that Adolph Rupp intended on not allowing African-Americans in the program? Was he, in fact, racist? You know, those kind of questions.
For Derek White, the black faculty member, he's a historian who studies sports history. He grew up in Kentucky, too. But at the end of the day, he says, in sports, people are judged by results.
We don't give them credit for just showing up to the game, right? We give them credit if they win. And in the case of Rupp, the results are that he had one black player in 42 years.
Since the letter was publicized about a month ago, the conversation on campus has died down, overtaken by worries about reopening amid the coronavirus pandemic and whether the football season will go on. The University of Kentucky has responded in some ways to the 10 demands. The school committed $10 million to studying issues of race and promised to work with the faculty members on other goals for equity and inclusion. But on the Rupp name, no word yet. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
But getting to know Patrick and those guys, John Thompson wanted to create great black men, and I'll always respect and admire him for that.
The sports world is mourning the death of a legendary college basketball coach. John Thompson has died at the age of 78. Thompson became the first African-American head coach to win a Division I NCAA title when he led the Georgetown Hoyas to the 1984 championship. As NPR's Tom Goldman reports, Thompson's legacy goes way beyond his many on-court victories.
Every remembrance today of John Thompson, including this one, mentions the 1984 honor that would make him bristle, first black head coach to win a major college basketball title.
I'm not interested in being the first or only black doing anything, because it implies that in 1984, a black man finally became intelligent enough to win the NCAA title, and that's a very misleading thing.
It's fitting to remember him now, when basketball players are rallying behind the phrase Black Lives Matter and refusing to take part in games as a protest against racial injustice. Thompson did all that decades ago. In 1989, he left the court before a game to protest an NCAA rule that he thought unfairly targeted minority students, which actually was something he spent his coaching career doing in a positive way. Thompson targeted young black men for college, many of them disadvantaged. Star guard Allen Iverson ended up in the Hall of Fame, but might not have if Thompson hadn't brought him to Georgetown after Iverson was involved in a brawl during high school.
No other schools were recruiting me anymore. My mom went to Georgetown and begged him to give me a chance. And he did.
For Thompson, though, those chances were merely a start. He wanted his players to parlay hoops into something more. His greatest player and current Georgetown head coach Patrick Ewing described to HBO the deflated ball Thompson kept in his office.
We still keep it in the office, and one of the things he always told us is that at some point the ball is going to stop bouncing. So, you know, you got to have a backup plan.
Most did. A reported 76 of Thompson's 78 players who stayed at Georgetown 4 years got their degrees. At 6'10", Thompson was an imposing figure, stalking the sidelines with a trademark white towel over his shoulder. He was tough and fatherly with his players. His closed practices and limited media access were part of a phenomenon that became known as Hoya paranoia. But in his 27 years at Georgetown, Thompson mostly was known for success. 14 straight NCAA tournament appearances, 3 Final Fours, and countless young men whose lives he guided and even, in some cases, saved. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
My second one is I was upstairs, and I know you mentioned white dog. This one involves dogs. So there were 3 white women as I was picking up the documents to take back downstairs. And someone mentioned chocolate lab, chocolate here again. And she was saying, well, oh, do you want a 3-legged chocolate lab? I guess she doesn't want the dog anymore or whatever. And this other white woman was saying that she has a small dog and she has to constantly watch him and he always gets into trouble. And a tell sign that he gives is he gives Chinese eyes. All right, she didn't use the word squint or any other term that shows that you're doing a certain type of thing with your eyes. She said he gets Chinese eyes or they get Chinese eyes when they are guilty and they know they've done something wrong.
It comes from China.
Poll numbers show Americans are growing more hostile towards China. It stems to some extent over how people believe China initially handled the coronavirus pandemic, but Chinese support for their own government has increased. NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Fang looks at what is driving this difference in public opinion between the two countries.
Americans don't like China. A recent Pew Research poll finds 73% have a negative attitude towards China, the highest since Pew began collecting such data in 2005. 78% say they blame, at least in part, the coronavirus pandemic and how China initially handled its outbreak. Chinese citizens feel the exact opposite way.
Surprisingly, it's actually increased their satisfaction and also their support toward their government.
Kerry Wu is a sociology professor at Canada's York University. And in April, he and several hundred Chinese student volunteers anonymously polled nearly 20,000 Chinese citizens about their government's handling of the coronavirus epidemic. He found about 2/3 of Chinese people were satisfied with their local provincial officials.
But if it's toward national government, it's 93% Chinese people. They say they're satisfied.
It's debatable whether polling data from China is accurate because participants may lie to avoid political retaliation. So Wu kept his survey completely anonymous to protect respondents, and his data is largely consistent with other polls in China that find high levels of satisfaction with the national government. Those numbers likely reflect the contrast between China and Western countries' handling of the pandemic.
The disappointing performance of Europe and the U.S. increased Chinese confidence in their own political system.
Qi Zhongxiang is head of Woming Technology, a self-billed public sentiment company that advises the Chinese Communist Party and government. He gained notoriety early this year when an analysis Woming wrote advising Beijing on how to head off public anger after the death of a whistleblowing doctor leaked. Now, he says the coronavirus pandemic gives China an opportunity to build up support at home.
The Chinese people have a more rational understanding of how the universal values the West promotes led to a slow epidemic response.
Values like free speech and personal freedom. Politics blogger Ren Yi, who writes under the moniker Chairman Rabbit, says the U.S.'s harder line over China's erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy is another factor.
Many who were once very friendly towards the U.S., who went to school there, including the so-called elites, the middle class, the cosmopolitan, urbanites, they have become very critical of the U.S. because they are patriots now too.
Those views are not accidental outcomes. Both countries' leaders have intentionally played up suspicion of the other to bolster their own popularity.
State media in China found that actually nationalism always sells.
Feng Kecheng is a communications professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He explains economic and political incentives lead Chinese media to play up eye-catching headlines that depict the U.S. as a failed state.
Nationalistic content has the potential to bring in more followers and more engagement, which means more advertising revenue. So you publish a lot of nationalism posts and the Communist Party is happy and you get tons of likes and shares.
So as nationalist outlets and hawkish sentiment in both the U.S. and China continue to gain traction, the real loser might be U.S.-China relations. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
I think this country was built on gangs. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this country still is run on gangs, Republicans, Democrats, the police department, the FBI, the CIA, those are gangs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The correctional officers. Mm-hmm. I had a correctional officer tell me straight up, we the biggest gang in New York State. Straight up. You know what I mean? It's this whole country is built on gangs.
Well, continuing on with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chittick. Protesters continue to decry the death of another black man at the hands of law enforcement. On Monday afternoon, L.A. County Sheriff's deputies stopped 29-year-old Dijon Kizzy, who'd been riding his bicycle in the Westmont neighborhood of South L.A. for what they call violations of vehicle codes. We're still not sure what that means. The sheriff's department says the shooting happened after they say Kizzy punched a deputy and then started running, and that they found a gun among items that he dropped, including some clothing, on the ground at the scene. Deputies shot Kizzy multiple times, some reports saying dozens of times. And meanwhile, in another sheriff's department shooting from earlier this summer, there's more information coming out about what happened when deputies shot and killed 18-year-old Andres Guardado in Gardena. A whistleblower at the department now claims there may have been some kind of interdepartment gang initiation involved in that shooting. A lot to unpack here, and Celeste Freeman from the website Witness LA is here to help us understand what's going on. Hey, Celeste.
Hey, Steve. It's quite a period, boy.
Yeah. I want to start with what happened this week, the most recent thing, which happened on Monday. There's no police body cam video of the shooting of Dijon Kizzy because the sheriff's department doesn't yet use body cams. Yesterday, the L.A. County Board of Supervisors voted to provide more than $25 million for a rollout of body cams. The LAPD has had them for several years, 5 years now. What's taken so long for the sheriff's department?
Well, to some degree, we can't quite blame our current sheriff for this. Our previous sheriff, Jim McDonnell, was a foot dragger on the body cam issue, and it just couldn't seem to get pushed through. But unfortunately, even when the body cams roll out in October, they're only going to be at, I believe, five stations. The rollout isn't going to be complete. It's going to be staged. From some perspectives, I'm sure that's an easier way to do it. But when we have everything going on that we have right now with police shootings, not having body cams for the fourth largest law enforcement agency in the nation is not good.
And we have yet another shooting, deputy-involved shooting, where, you know, if there had been a body cam on these deputies, we would see what had happened.
Right.
Do you think that will accelerate the process to get more body cams on more deputies?
I don't know if it's going to accelerate the process because the process is complicated. It would be good if it did, but with the Kizzy shooting, which is the shooting you're talking about, that's the most recent, where this young man appears to have been shot a minimum of 12 times, and, you know, maybe a lot more, or maybe 20 or in excess of 20.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
But with the Kizzy shooting, which is the shooting you're talking about, that's the most recent, where this young man appears to have been shot a minimum of 12 times, and, you know, maybe a lot more, or maybe 20 or in excess of 20. And what we got yesterday from the Sheriff's Department is that Mr. Kizzy was on a bike and was being stopped by deputies for some vehicle code infraction. And then he dropped the bike, took off, and the deputies chased him, and he was carrying some bundle of clothing, or, you know, which almost looked like, you know, a bit of laundry, and he dropped it. And reportedly, when he dropped it, there was a gun inside. So the deputies opened up on him and shot him this extraordinary number of times. When, as far as we know, if he was armed, he wasn't armed anymore, because everyone admits that the gun was down. But now, then, yesterday, what we got is Mr. Kizzy was, when they shot him, he was leaning over and starting to reach for the gun. And whether that's true or not, we have no way of knowing. But if we had a body cam, we'd know if that was true, because that's, of course, an easy thing to say, when it's really the word of the deputies against people viewing this from a great distance.
Let's shift now to Andres Guardado. This shooting happened earlier in the summer, back in June. The board yesterday, Celeste, also decided to look into the possibility of suing the Sheriff's Department over its unwillingness to share information about that shooting in Gardena. What's the backstory to that, and why does the Board of Supervisors think it's necessary to sue its own sheriff's department, or even the sheriff himself?
Well, first of all, the sheriff put a hold on the coroner's report, which happens from time to time, and then the sheriff will not allow the Office of the Inspector General to really have the ability to investigate or be present when investigations are going on, in very controversial shootings like this one, or in a lot of other situations where civilian oversight is really needed and appropriate. Yesterday at the board meeting, Max Huntsman, the inspector general, was talking about, once again, he can get nothing, and his computer access to files that he had under Sheriff Jim McDonald is completely shut off. And the sheriff is actually still engaged in a criminal investigation against the inspector general, which does not suggest cooperation. So the motion yesterday pretty much lays a gun on the table and says, if you don't cooperate, you know, if you don't, we are empowered to enforce the need for cooperation.
I want to talk about this whistleblower who came out this week, a whistleblower who works at the Compton office of the Sheriff's Department. The department's been under fire for alleged gangs of deputies operating at some of its bureaus. There's one gang called the Executioners. The deputy who shot and killed Guardado works in the Compton office, a guy named Miguel Vega. Now, another deputy, this whistleblower, says that Vega was trying to become a member of the Executioners. Let's hear from the whistleblower.
How about this latest shooting of Andres Guardado? Was that done by an inked member or a prospect of the Executioners?
Prospect.
And who was that prospect? You know?
Lax Foundation. Speculation and conjecture on the part of the witness.
Deputy Vega and Deputy Hernandez.
Deputy Vega, you just heard. An inked member, you heard inked member, is someone with the tattoo. So Deputy Vega may have been chasing ink. This is what the whistleblower claims, trying to become a member of this deputy gang called the Executioners. Why is that important in this case, Celeste?
Well, the Executioners, from what we know, and Witness LA has some sources inside Compton, you know, he's aggressive, seems to have an us versus them perspective between themselves and the community. And what we know from our own sources inside the Compton station is that the deputy who shot Andres Guardado, his training officer is high up in the Executioners and was considered to some degree an enforcer. In fact, he's been named by two other whistleblowers as someone who beat down another deputy who he didn't think was hardcore enough. And that guy who is an executioner was the training officer for this deputy who shot Mr. Cordaldo.
So much information, obviously, to talk about. Celeste Freeman from Witness LA helping us understand some important news at the Sheriff's Department. Celeste, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
The man knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Yesterday, Joe Prude told me about his brother Daniel.
We had a wonderful relationship as brothers, you know, and, you know, like I said before and I keep saying, you know, Daniel was very charismatic, you know, he was a good dude all the way around. He was, you know, down to earth, a good, generous man at heart. He loved the individuals as himself as a human being. And the much overall in his sums him up, man, you know, he was a good Samaritan.
On March 23rd, Joe Prude got worried. His brother had a history with mental illness, and he just wasn't acting like himself. Earlier in that day, he had sent his brother to a psychiatric hospital. They released him hours later. Joe Prude says Daniel wasn't properly evaluated, and he wasn't given any medication to help. The two brothers were talking together in Joe's house.
We was laughing and reminiscing about old days.
Joe then left the room for a moment, and when he returned, his brother Daniel was gone. Because of Daniel's mental health issues, Joe called 911.
For a person like that that you love so much to just disappear in thin air, it's like, wow. How did I lose sight of him that quick when I had my whole eye on him the whole time? And in the process, like, of me trying to figure out which way he went, I immediately got on the phone with 911. This is what the outcome? I called him for to lynch my brother? I didn't call him to come help my brother die. I called him to come help me get my brother some help.
What happened when the police showed up?
Well, when the police showed back up to my house for the call after, you know, me placing the call to them once again, you know, officer asked me, is anything wrong with him? I said, no. He said, well, is he a threat to anybody? I said, yeah, to himself. But he ain't no threat to nobody else, and don't y'all kill my brother.
Daniel Prude had left his brother's house in below-freezing temperatures, wearing just long underwear and a tank top. When police caught up with him, he was naked, and the newly released body cam footage shows police putting some kind of hood over his head. Prude gasps for air and vomits.
Everything that they did, they didn't have to do. That excessive force they used on him, the push-up stands on his neck, the knee in his back, holding his legs, that wasn't called for. They didn't have no dignity in what they was doing to my brother. They treated my brother like he was an animal in the street, a stray.
According to police reports, Daniel Prude eventually fell unconscious and stopped breathing. The Prude family believes the police are responsible for his death.
I want to know if them officers are going to lose their job and be punished just like any other civilian. And I really would love to see them stand in front of a judge and have a prosecution just like they prosecuted my brother. They was the judge and the jury and executioners.
Joe Prude talking to us about his brother Daniel Prude. Police took Daniel into custody on March 23rd and he died a week later. Joe Prude says it was another 2 months before his family was informed that Daniel's death was a homicide.
Mama says police mistreat black people.
Louisville, Kentucky is on edge as residents await a decision on whether the officers who killed Breonna Taylor will be charged. That decision is occurring amid recent leaks that suggest Taylor was closely linked to drug trafficking. Amina Alahi of member station WFPL in Louisville reports that some say there is a smear campaign underway.
From the cover of Vanity Fair's September issue, Breonna Taylor gazes evenly at the viewer, seafoam dress flowing. The painting is the elevated form of the many popular tributes depicting Taylor, at times wreathed in flowers or even wearing a halo. Ever since her story caught the nation's attention in May, 2 months after police shot and killed her at home, supporters have highlighted her best attributes. Taylor was an emergency room technician. She dreamed of becoming a nurse. She was fun. Most importantly, they say, she was innocent.
Obviously, Breonna's passing has been a terrible tragedy for the community and for her family.
That's Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher.
Any attempt to link her is just not relevant to the investigation that's taking place right now, so it's not helpful.
Mayor Fisher says Taylor didn't deserve to die, and it would be unjust to draw conclusions based on limited information. He says attempts to sway opinion and influence the investigation are, quote, wrong and divisive. The mayor has criticized leaked documents, like the report on Taylor's alleged link to drug trafficking, which was reportedly compiled after Taylor's killing. A representative for the Louisville Metro Police Department declined to comment, citing the ongoing investigation. Lonita Baker is an attorney representing Taylor's family in a wrongful death lawsuit.
If people thought she was a drug dealer, it would not have justified her murder the way that she was murdered.
Baker denies Taylor was involved in drugs or was even still connected to her ex-boyfriend Jamarcus Glover, a main target of the investigation that led police to her door. Baker says even if the allegations were true, it wouldn't matter.
Once people are able to see all of the evidence, they will agree that she was not.
Plainclothes police shot and killed Taylor during a middle-of-the-night raid. Her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, fired one shot because he says he thought they were intruders. Police say that shot injured an officer. Police returned fire with five bullets striking Taylor and killing her. Criminal investigations by Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron and the FBI are pending. Baker thinks there have been intentional attempts to smear Taylor's name, so another lawyer on Baker's team posted an image of a plea offer for Taylor's ex-boyfriend Glover that listed Taylor as a co-defendant. Glover says he didn't take the offer from the district attorney because Taylor wasn't involved.
It's disappointing. It borders along the lines of unethical.
But the district attorney, Tom Wine, defended his actions. In a statement, he emphasized it was the family's lawyer who released the plea document that smeared Taylor by reminding the public that Glover used her to further his drug trafficking. Wine said he had Taylor's name removed from the final draft and did not release either version out of respect to Taylor and due to the ongoing investigations. Kristen Nicole Dukes, the dean for institutional diversity at Allegheny College, has studied how people assign fault to victims in fictional shooting situations.
If you paint this negative black stereotypic portrayal of the victim in the media, what you get is this lasting implication in the arena of public opinion.
Her research found describing a fictional victim that way led study participants to blame the victim more and the shooter less, even when it came to charging them. Duke says the public wants information about shooting victims, and in some cases it humanizes them. But Taylor's image is more complicated.
We're able to talk about humans, everyday people, flaws and all. Breonna Taylor isn't being afforded that opportunity. And in that way, she isn't human. She's being superhuman.
She says it doesn't matter whether Taylor was good or bad. What matters is justice. For NPR News, I'm Amina Elahi in Louisville.
I honestly question if I would still be living and or what my mental health would be. So, yeah, I don't know why. I don't know where I would be if I stayed in Wisconsin.
President Trump has paid a visit to the riot-torn city of Kenosha in Wisconsin, ignoring pleas from local leaders to stay away and accusations that the trip is an election stunt. On arrival, the president visited properties and businesses damaged during unrest following the police shooting of an unarmed black man, Jacob Blake, last month. At a news conference, Mr. Trump defended the actions of police and accused the media of focusing on bad incidents involving police officers.
The sad thing is you can do 10,000 great jobs as a policeman or a policewoman. You can do an incredible job for years, and then you have one bad apple or something happens that's bad. And that's the nightly news for 3 weeks. That's all they talk about. They don't talk about the thousands and thousands of good jobs, the lives that you save. They never talk about.
Earlier, the president described the protests as domestic terror. Mr. Trump didn't meet members of Jacob Blake's family or indeed the man himself, paralyzed and in hospital. Speaking just ahead of Mr. Trump's arrival in the city, Jacob Blake's uncle Justin had this to say.
We don't have any words for the orange man. All I ask is that he keep his disrespect, his foul language far away from our family. Absolutely. We need a president that's going to unite our country and take us in a different direction.
Should he have come today? Should he have come to? Should he have come today?
It's a free country. We can go anywhere we want. We want the same rights he got, and we want to be able to get our children home safely because they should be able to go anywhere in this nation and come back home safe.
Justin Blake. I got more on President Trump's visit from our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donohue.
Well, he visited two venues. First of all, he visited a furniture shop, I think, that had been hit by the looting and the destruction, commiserated with the owners there. And then he went to a school where the emergency services had been coordinating and spoke to various members of law enforcement. There were various people from Congress there. The Attorney General, Bill Barr, had travelled with him, as had the acting Homeland Security Secretary. He announced that he was giving $4 million to local businesses to compensate them from what had happened, and $1 million to the local police force. So there was some money on offer as well. But really what he did, Jonathan, was to repeat this law and order message that he's been shaping over the last week or two, really running through those particular sound bites in a way that he hopes will cut through to people out there in the electorate who are worried about law and order issues.
Gary, the mayor of Kenosha didn't want him to come. The governor of Wisconsin didn't want him to come. And it seems a bit strange for a politician to make a visit when they're not necessarily going to be popular when they get there. So why was it so important to him to go?
Well, you're right, of course. Both the governor and the mayor said he shouldn't come. And, of course, he hasn't met any of those people from the family of the man who was shot 7 times in the back, Jacob Blake. He's only really met one side of the argument, if you like, in Kenosha. But he's also, don't forget, surrounded himself with lots of pictures, lots of photo opportunities with police officers, with members of law enforcement. And that's what the president is trying to achieve here politically. He's staking a lot on this law and order message in his campaign, much as Richard Nixon did back in the late 60s, although he wasn't president at the time. And the risk, of course, for the president here is that people say, well, look, you know, if law and order needs fixing and there's riots and trouble on the streets, you've been in charge. Why is it happening on your watch? That's the risk, of course. But he does believe this is a strong issue for him.
So are some people viewing this as just an election stunt?
Some will say that, absolutely. I mean, it's not uncommon for presidents to go to places where there have been these kinds of incidents. It's a little uncommon for them to go in the teeth of opposition from the local administration. But I think, you know, it's clearly something that fits in with the agenda as he sees it at the moment. He believes that there are a lot of not just white voters, but Hispanic and black voters that are concerned about law and order issues, that may be wavering, may be thinking, well, will it be more of this if Joe Biden is elected? That's the image he wants to force home. I mean, he's been very, very cautious about criticizing the police at all in respect of this particular incident, and he said over the last day or so drawn some extraordinary analogies, saying that they have a quarter second to make a decision and some of them choke. And he says it's a bit like playing golf, where you can fluff a 3-foot putt, which is an analogy that I think may be a little tone deaf. Certainly some people will say that.
Gary O'Donohue.
That's right, we move it to Mississippi, and you know how that's spelled. Crooked letter I.
Curtis Flowers of Montgomery County is a free man for the first time in 23 years.
Attorney General Lynn Fitch announced that her office is now dropping the case after 6 trials. 12 News' Alex Love spoke to the Mississippi Center for Justice and other investigative reporters following the case. He joins us with the why. The timing happened now. Alex?
Absolutely, Byron. So when the defense attorneys and other journalists analyzed the case, they discovered that there were several red flags, from witnesses pressured to lie under oath and the district attorney purposely discriminating against black jurors.
1 year ago, he was sitting in a prison cell on death row. Now Curtis Flowers is all smiles as he removed his ankle bracelet with all charges dropped.
This is a primary example of such inappropriate action within our legal system. We see this as an opportunity for people to understand just how a miscarriage of justice can occur.
In the state's motion, Attorney General Fitch pointed out evidence today shows Flowers was the only one with no conflicting statements, while another was convicted on federal tax fraud, and the only witness still living admitted he was lying about Flowers making a jailhouse confession.
There were people that were basically jailhouse snitches who just flat lied and admitted they lied. You know, just they were trying to get out of their own charges.
He worked out a deal with the district attorney where he gave the DA what the DA wanted, the DA would give him what he wanted, which was leniency. This is a man, Odell Hallman, who has a very long violent criminal record.
As journalists and the defense looked further, they found Montgomery County DA Doug Evans violated the Constitution, purposely excluding African Americans from serving on the jury.
We looked at this prosecutor and his office's history of striking black people from jury selection at nearly 4.5 times the rate they were striking white people from juries. A very clear pattern of racial discrimination in jury selection.
This mess dragged Flowers through 6 trials before DA Doug Evans stepped down from the case. Those who followed it closely hope in the future the public puts more accountability on their prosecutors.
At the furniture store where the murders occurred in Montgomery County, Flowers was at one time an employee there, but researchers believe the only suspicion leading to these accusations was racial stereotyping.
Last week, during protests in Wisconsin against police brutality in the shooting of Jacob Blake, a white teenager who was armed with an AR-15-style rifle killed 2 of the protesters and injured a 3rd. In a video from before the shooting, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse said he and other armed vigilantes were there to protect property. In a subsequent video which captured the shooting and its aftermath, Rittenhouse throws his hands in the air, his rifle dangling in front of his chest, and walks toward police in heavily armored vehicles. Police, however, appear to ignore Rittenhouse, driving right past him. He was arrested later in a neighboring town and has since been charged with homicide. He's expecting an extradition trial in September. Rittenhouse's presence at the protest in Kenosha, however, are part of a larger trend. According to data that postdoctoral fellow Alexander Reed Ross recently shared with HuffPost, white vigilantes and far-right actors have also shown up at least 497 times at Black Lives Matter protests during the year. Ross's data also documents 64 incidents of simple assault carried out by the far-right at protests, and 9 incidents where vigilantes shot at protesters. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we break down the relationship between armed white vigilantes and law enforcement. I'm joined by Michael German, a former FBI special agent and a fellow at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Alice Sperry, a journalist at The Intercept covering justice. Alice, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, let's start with you. There's been a lot of speculation about the ideology of Kyle Rittenhouse and whether he was connected to any specific far-right groups. What do we know so far?
Not very much, frankly. One thing that people have to understand is that there is basically no obstacle joining these groups. If you wanted to put on a Hawaiian shirt and a flak jacket over that and carry some heavy weapons in public, you would automatically be representing the Boogaloo movement. These organizations don't have top-down organizational structure and heavy membership requirements. They're pretty fluid, and that's both by design, a practice called leaderless resistance that they use to because they understand that they're under police scrutiny, but also because they need members. They need people who will contribute or participate in these events. So if they start having any kind of rigorous screening process, they'll not have very many people showing up with them.
Michael, in the video of Rittenhouse, he's one of the videos at least, he clearly says that he's there to protect businesses. That's in his words. Michael, what is this ID? Who has deputized these folks? And we're talking largely about white men in these militias who are armed. Who has deputized them to come around the country and sort of, in their own words, protect people and businesses?
Well, that's just it. Nobody has. And these militants are acting as vigilantes, claiming to have a positive mission during the protests. But again, they're completely unregulated. They have no legal authority to be there. And as we see in many of these cases, it's not just, you know, a business hiring a security guard. You know, most states have licensing requirements for security guards, particularly armed security guards, because number one, you don't want people who aren't allowed to have weapons to be carrying out those duties. But also you want to make sure they have proper liability insurance for when they make a mistake. So this is not any sort of a legal operation at all, which is what's troubling about the police allowing this activity to happen. And they've done it so much for so long, since over the last couple of years, that it's not surprising that people believe that they're authorized to go out and do that. And that's because law enforcement has not been aggressive in tackling the legal violations these militants engage in while they're out at these protests.
Alice, when we see the video of Rittenhouse, which we described at the very top of the segment here, he again is walking hands up in the air, has just shot multiple people, killed two people, and these armored vehicles are just driving right past him. I mean, this was a stunning display of how law enforcement either, you know, willingly or not, just ignored this threat. How common is that, Alice?
I think law enforcement is quite comfortable with the presence of individuals like this and groups like this. And in fact, government has known about, you know, the threat posed by far-right white supremacists, right-wing extremists for a long time, and it hasn't really done a whole lot to address it. And not only that, but we also know that the government institutions and you know, the FBI, for instance, have been very much aware of the close ties between these groups and these individuals and law enforcement itself. And that's something that the public has rarely been made aware of. It's something that, you know, the FBI is certainly not discussing publicly, even though they're very much on alert about this threat. We actually published a report in 2017, a leaked FBI internal document that warned that white supremacist groups and far-right groups were actively seeking to infiltrate law enforcement. And, you know, the document basically noted that domestic terrorism investigations often identified active links between these white supremacist extremists, militia extremists, sovereign citizen extremists, and law enforcement officers. But other than that, and this again was a leaked document, there hasn't been a whole lot of public discussion about this. And there's a reason for that, and that is a political reason. There were reports in the past that that kind of raised the alarm around this threat, and they were condemned. They were there was a big upheaval in response to those reports. The government was forced to basically walk them back. And so that's why we aren't seeing a lot of discussions, public discussions about this yet.
Michael, to Alice's point, I want to play a clip here from FBI Director last year, Christopher Wray, talking about the threat of white supremacist violence in the U.S.
And I will say that a majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence, but it includes other things as well.
Michael, are these militia groups part of what Wray is describing there in terms of domestic terror threats and white supremacist domestic terror threats in particular?
So the FBI divides their domestic terrorism portfolio into a number of different categories. And it had a separate category for white supremacists. When I was working undercover in the 1990s, they were one category, white supremacists and far-right militants, because there's a lot of overlap between these groups, again, with the low barriers of entry. But they changed that over time and had separate groups for white supremacists and far-right militants. It's a interesting way that Wray frames that, because what we have to understand is that white supremacists and far-right militants are far more active than any of the other categories of domestic terrorists that the FBI designates. So it's a bit of a subterfuge to say we do more investigations against these groups. And that's why in 2017, Senator Durbin introduced a bill, the Domestic Terrorism Protection Act, that would have required the FBI to produce the data showing the number of what they're considering terrorism incidents, and particularly the deaths from those incidents, on one side of the ledger, and the number of investigations the FBI has initiated in each category. So as a result of that bill being introduced, it hadn't even passed, the FBI collapsed its categories so that white supremacists and what the FBI had previously called black identity extremists were shoved into one category, so it would be unclear which group was more active and which group had the most investigations opened against them.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
The FBI collapsed its categories so that white supremacists and what the FBI had previously called black identity extremists were shoved into one category, so it would be unclear which group was more active and which group had the most investigations opened against them. And I think that was a way of hiding the fact that even though white supremacists and far-right militants are far more active than any other group, the FBI actually had a disproportionate number of investigations targeting groups like what the FBI calls eco-terrorists, even though there's no homicides relating to environmental activism in the United States, or these so-called black identity extremists, which, again, there isn't really a black identity movement out there. It was a fictitious category created to basically lump any black militant into a single category to try to build up the idea that there was this movement that doesn't actually exist.
Well, and there's also, Alicia, I wonder if you have any thoughts on this, because there's also just the I think what was so stunning about the video is because when we often talk about what Michael's describing, you know, identity extremists here and the idea of who owns and walks around freely with guns and rifles in the way that Rittenhouse did. You know, the differences are striking. If we're talking about black people who are heavily armed, who decide to, you know, put themselves into a militia position, I don't suspect that the outcome would be the same with law enforcement.
Absolutely. And I think actually one of the most telling and tragically ironic things about the Black Identity Extremism report is that it was released by the FBI internally in August 2017, just one week before the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where we know a white nationalist drove into a crowd and killed Heather Heyer, a counter-protester. So I think just that episode tells you, you know, while the FBI was focusing on kind of concocting this non-existent threat and warning thousands of law enforcement departments across the country about the supposed black identity extremism threat, there was real organizing going on that led to real violence just a week later. So I think that kind of speaks to that disparity a little.
And Alicia, what are some of the, in your reporting, what are some of the links that we know between law enforcement and themselves and some white extremist groups?
I mean, there have been a number of episodes over the years. I mean, there's been cases in almost every state. Actually, Mike just published a report about this. But in Los Angeles, for instance, there were members of a local sheriff's department that had formed a neo-Nazi gang in the 90s. In Chicago, there was a police detective that was rumored KKK member that was essentially like torturing hundreds of black men over decades. There was in Cleveland, there were officials that were found to scrawl racist and Nazi graffiti in their locker rooms. There are so many examples that we can think about. And just today, we saw some news actually out of Gotham. It's actually published a story about racist symbolism and language used by a precinct in Brooklyn. And even though not every officer is, you know, a member of the Klan, and in fact, a vast majority of officers are not, I think we cannot really talk about policing in the U.S. without talking about the racist history of policing in the U.S. You know, the police in this country started as slave patrols. And so from the beginning, policing existed to maintain a racial hierarchy in this country. And so we cannot really talk about reforming policing or addressing racial bias in policing without understanding that history. And of course, we're not saying every cop is a white supremacist, but policing as an institution was founded as a tool of white supremacy. And I think it has largely continued to function that way. And that's kind of what we're seeing on display in Kenosha.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
A murder suspect wanted in connection with a shooting in Portland, Oregon, was killed by law enforcement last night near Olympia in Washington State. Michael Forrest Rennell was 48 years old and a self-identified anti-fascist protester. He was wanted for allegedly killing a far right-wing demonstrator last weekend. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson has been covering the story and joins us on the line from Portland. Conrad, good morning.
Good morning.
What do we know at this point about what happened last night?
Well, yesterday, a judge here in Portland issued an arrest warrant for Michael Rennell. The warrant was for the murder of a supporter of a far right-wing group who had been in a protest last Saturday. According to the U.S. Marshals Service, around 7:30 last evening, they tried to arrest Rennell near Olympia, which is about 2 hours north of Portland. The marshals say they attempted to peacefully arrest him, but that he had a firearm and threatened the lives of law enforcement officers. The officers then shot Rennell. He was pronounced dead at the scene. According to the marshals, no law enforcement officers were injured. And we should just say that, you know, there are many details we don't know yet about what's happened. And you know, it's very much so a developing story.
Right. And all of this happened on the same night Vice News actually aired an interview with Rennell, right? What did we learn from that?
Yeah. So let's go back to Saturday night. Rennell was involved in racial justice protests in Portland. This was the same day as a massive caravan of vehicles drove through and around Portland in support of President Trump. Rennell told Vice News that he saw this caravan and headed downtown. So you have this environment with left and right-wing protesters coming together. Rennell was in the middle of it on the side of the racial justice protesters. And in the interview, he appears to confirm that he shot at someone. That person was Aaron J. Danielson, a supporter of this far right-wing regional political group called Patriot Prayer. They've engaged in violence during Portland protests since 2016 when they were established. And here's what Rennell told Vice.
I felt that my life and other people around me's lives were in danger. And I felt like I had no choice but to do what I did.
He went on to say he realized what he did, and he said he was confident that he, quote, did not hit anyone innocent.
What do we know about Michael Rennell?
Well, as you said at the top, he was 48 years old. He had two children. He was estranged from his mother and sister. I spoke to his sister last night, and even though they hadn't spoken in years, she was clearly very upset. More recently, Rennell faced a series of criminal charges. Police reports from June show that in rural Oregon, he was pulled over for reckless driving, going more than 100 miles per hour. The trooper who pulled him over found a handgun for which he didn't have a concealed handgun license. The trooper also found unidentified prescription pills and cannabis. Rennell was arrested for a DUI at the time. And a month later, Rennell was cited in downtown Portland by police for interfering with an officer and possession of a loaded firearm in a public place.
So all this comes as the protests continue in Portland, right? What's happening with those now?
Yeah. We're coming up with the 100th night of protests. There are concerns about potential violence this weekend. There's a memorial for the Patriot Prayer supporter who was killed last weekend. And because there's a similar rally of Trump supporters scheduled for Monday and on Labor Day, you know, the real worry is that these two killings, you know, someone supporting the far left and another supporting the far right will inflame an already very tense political situation here and potentially across the country. You know, Portland's mayor, the police chief, Oregon's governor are pleading with people to stop the violence, but no one seems to have a plan on how to end it.
Conrad Wilson from Oregon Public Broadcasting, thank you.
You're welcome.
We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America.
And we have an update to a story that aired yesterday on the show. The White House has responded to our interview with Elizabeth Newman. She's the former Department of Homeland Security official who told our co-host Steve that during her years in the administration, President Trump was reluctant to focus on right-wing extremism. Here she is.
And the irony is that when he finally was comfortable with using the word domestic terrorism, it was in the context of Antifa and trying to exploit or sell a story that the looting and the violence that we have seen somewhat associated with peaceful protests is Antifa. And yet, if you look at the arrests that have occurred in the protests of the summer, it's the Boogaloo movement, or it's an association with QAnon. It's the right side of the spectrum. It is not Antifa.
In a statement responding to that interview, the White House said that Newman sounds like a, quote, disgruntled employee. That statement, however, does not dispute any of the details of her account. The full interview and the White House statement can be found online at npr.org.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 5th, 2020, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions to offer. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to discuss. Wow, what a year. What a week. I thought today, I was thinking, it's been such a terrible year. I said, man, so if they have the technology at some point, you could actually send yourself a one-page letter. You could send it back to yourself at the beginning of the year to kind of help you prepare and even see if you could be on the come up, as they say, give you some tips, right? So you could have kind of a mildly bountiful or maybe even a great bounty within all the misery of 2020. What would you say in that one-page letter? And I thought, wow, like, the enormity of this year, like, it would be hard to capture in a page to even prepare someone for what this year is going to offer. And we've only seen about, you know, 70% of it, 75% of it. So, I mean, and we still got an election in November and, you know, who knows? But I said, wow, I think I would have to start just saying that, like, wow, this is going to be a, wait a minute. I said, so if I'm sending a letter to myself at the beginning of the year, we were in Florida for the counter-racist yoga retreat, which was even more mind-boggling to remember, like, wow, did this year start in Florida? Whew. So I said, line one would be hurry up and get the hell out of Florida. Like, woof, don't touch, no hugs to firefighter, anybody, just get the hell out of there. So then, this is going to be a horrendous year. Self-care, extraordinarily important. If there was going to be anything on the, invest in toilet paper, like make sure your toilet paper stock is extraordinary, canned goods, generator, we heard that, non-toxic generator. Invest in hand sanitizer. I was thinking, like, financially, like Purell, find some of the companies and invest in hand sanitizer. Invest in Zoom. Dump your airline stocks, right? That would be come up. Save quarters, and then you would have to put in parentheses, like, literally, save quarters. All caps, the coins, nickels, dimes, save coins. That's like the magnitude of this year. It would be hard to capture in one. Like, even when I paused to think about it, I said, so if I was sending myself this information for January of 2020, Kobe Bryant is about to die in a helicopter crash along with his daughter and seven others. That wouldn't even be included in the memo. Chadwick Boseman's passing, like a whole lot of things that happened this year, would not be included in the memo. It would just be like, oh my God, this was days away and you didn't even mention, and it was, you haven't, 2020, wow. Anyway, so on our misery of 2020, we touched on the passing of Chadwick Boseman last Saturday, and I think it had just, like, literally minutes before we went on the air, I just saw the report, so it was kind of, I think a lot of folks were not aware, were just finding out. I think Thomas in New York said something about it, but I mean, that's, I think a lot of folks are still commenting about, as well as the passing of John Thompson, coach at George, University of Georgetown, which happened just at the beginning of the week, so lots of misery to offer in this year with Chadwick Boseman. I wanted to make sure that I was sincere, even though it's, you know, I mean, talk about the disgrace of white supremacy racism. Him passing away at the age of 43. The disgrace of white supremacy racism. Medical apartheid in there as well. But I said, man, I got to make sure that I'm authentic. That's why we had the sound clip from 42, and I so appreciate it, because I said that is authentic to the cows in every sense, because we even got Negra in there, the appropriate pronunciation of the word. But I said we have to be authentic to Gus T, because I could not come on here and play a sound clip from Black Panther or, you know, say, oh, man, in my trip, watching Marvel's Black Panther all week long, and Wakanda forever. I could not do that because I have not seen the film. I am not going to watch the film, even though I think it is horrendous, the passing of Mr. Boseman at such a young age. But I will say the exact same thing that I said when the film came out. All of the victims who have celebrated and rejoiced about this film, you sound exactly like the white chicks in my Seattle yoga classes. That notwithstanding, horrendous loss, purpose. Thought his words were important at Howard University, HBCUs. Purpose. John, talk about purpose. Georgetown's John Thompson. Purpose. I am here, and specifically to assist black males. Like, wow. John Thompson, has been a terrible year, 2020. Let's see. We got to hear one of my favorite sound clips where they were giving the report on China. 4 more years. When I heard that report, I said, man, I don't need to see the debates. I don't even need to watch the news. I would be very comfortable if someone said, Gus T, we're going to lock you away, greater confinement, so you'll have no Wi-Fi, no newspapers, no nothing from now until November. But you can place a wager, and it'll have to be everything on who's going to win the election. I would have no problem. Everything. 4 more years. No problem. That report that I was already very confident, but that report right there, it is a done deal. And then you get the corroboration caller in Florida. He just said that days ago. He just said that. Get those Chinese eyes, and I know he's about to take a chunk out of somebody. Get them Chinese eyes, and it come from China. And all of us like, oh man, everybody hates China. 4 more years. Very, very easy call. And just, you know, Gus T is a regular candidate for Coon of the Year, so I might not know what I'm talking about. Anybody who thinks it's going to be Biden, and or anybody who is just not sure. I don't, you know, I'm not sure how things are going to play out. Definitely speak up, because Gus T has been known to make an error or 12, so I could be incorrect. However, generally, or I can't even say generally, since we've been picking U.S. presidential elections, we do not make errors there. Not yet, anyway. Let's see. We had a report last week. I forgot. There were so many things that happened last week, so many things that happened this year. We had an audio report where they were talking about the vaccine trials and not having enough non-white people participating in the COVID-19 vaccine trials. And they mentioned it. Number one, the report was black and brown people. That right there was enough, you know, halt everything. Now, they did, within the report, they at least did acknowledge that when we're talking about the history of white supremacy racism in this area of the world, we're talking about black people. This would not be a black and brown brothers, black and brown sisters type thing. This would be a black people being targeted type thing. Now, the additional problems, when they went to that area, they limited it to the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. That's why I'm so glad, and why Harriet A. Washington's Medical Apartheid, full title is Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on not black and brown Americans, it's Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to Present. The Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment is one chapter in this amazing book, top five, in our book club. But it's just one chapter. It also includes whites plotting and theorizing about chemically, biologically conducting warfare on Nelson Mandela so that they could change his conduct and behavior, maybe even poison him. And he was having dinner with white people who were thinking about these ideas. It also talks about having mosquitoes attack black people in Florida. They always got some kind of scheme happening down in Florida. They just had a report about mosquitoes being released, genetically modified mosquitoes being released. We had just talked about that. But that's in Medical Apartheid. Attacking black people once they die so that you do not get a piece of land that's yours even in death. No way. We'll come and dig up your corpse for medical experimentation, organ harvesting, just to play around with your eyeballs, whatever it happens to be. Lots of that, and that this went on for a long time. Oh, it was appalling to hear that reduced to, not to mention, I mean, we could talk about that, top five, medical apartheid. But to reduce that to simply, oh, Tuskegee syphilis experiment is another act of white supremacy racism, because presumably the people who put these reports together at NPR and the BBC and WNYC Public Radio in New York have access to staff that are way better than perennial Coon of the Year, Gus T. Renegade. Certainly you know of Harriet A. Washington. Do your research. Next. Curtis Flowers, they're not going to try him for a seventh time. I heard that and I thought, wow, they should put Curtis Flowers on the Mississippi state flag. Like, it would be appropriate in like a billion different ways. Like, this is what the history, the state of Mississippi is all about right here. Black male, if we can't lynch you and chop off your penis, Emmett Till, we will put you in jail for something you probably didn't do and try you about 15 times, maybe 16. Curtis, they should just put him on the flag. Take down all that nonsense and put Curtis, or put Curtis Flowers with six magnolias. I think that would be perfect. Submit that. Curtis Flowers and six magnolias for the Mississippi state flag. Black male privilege. Militant, did you hear the report? Close to the end there, they were talking about the FBI's conduct and how they categorized these extremist acts, right? the black identity extremists, that's just some fiction that they made up, a lie, that they made up, white people, in order to be able to go after militants. Man, as many times as Gus T. Renegade has been labeled a militant, I don't have a pea shooter. And I know for sure that Gus T. Renegade, black identity extremist, known for lugging bricks and intimidating white females in Seattle yoga classes. Potential rapist, mugger. You got Kyle Rittenhouse. The rest of these whites, they are out with AR-15s, and the rest of them, they're not extremists. They're right wing. Man, that word white, right wing, is worthy of study. It is in the word guide. It is recommended by Mr. Neely Fuller that we not use the word right wing. All of that is a part of deception and confusion. But you see how consistent they have been in using that? That was all in the report about what was happening in Portland. Right wing. Come on now. But the militants, and they did that. That's another one, that FBI deceptive conduct. When we talk about white people being ignorant about racism, white supremacy, that is not the conduct of someone who is ignorant. That is willful deception. Lots of patterns of that in the system of racism. Let's see. Speaking of, I mentioned black male privilege. The section on, or the report on Dijon Kizzy, black male in California, a black cyclist in California who was shot, they said 12, 15, 20, may have been more than that. Are people aware of this case since we got black male privilege? Everybody was aware of this case, right? Before today? Everyone knew all the details, right? Oh, yeah, we heard that. Yeah. I seriously, that's another one. I will take that wager. If you are listening, this is one I prefer we not have spectators. At least unmute your line. Gus T., you're a coon. Biden's going to win in November. And yeah, I knew about Dijon Kizzy. What are you talking about? I would like to take that wager because I suspect you got a whole lot of folks who did not know about that case, because I can even tell you the details. When I found out about that case, or how I found out about that case, was from listening to that report. Not live, but when I found, I'm listening to it. I was not listening to that report because I was outraged about, oh my goodness, Dijon Kizzy was shot 22 times or 25, who knows, 35 times, whatever it is. That's not it. I was listening to that report because the executioners, like, what? You got a gang within the gang? And it's called the executioners? That's the name that they, and then it suggested you got whistleblowers. Perhaps this is a white person, I don't know. Fellow officers who are saying that they're going out and killing people, non-white people, in order to get, like, boost their reputation within the gang, the executioner, like, that's why I was listening to that report, to get details on that. And on the way, I will even tell you, they were talking about the Dijon Kizzy case. When they started, I said, oh, man, another one of these shootings. What is the man not? What did he say? Here we go again. Oh, yes, the black gas, he got shot. Yeah. And they went through the details. I said, yeah, he got shot 20 times, 23. And I said, whoa. 20. Again, black male privilege. Worthy of, you know, dozens of bullets, not just one. And then the black male privilege, of course, since we all love and care about the black male so much, everybody knows about Dijon Kizzy and has t-shirts and hashtags and pictures and sent his family $50,000 every day. You know, everybody has been doing that for the past, I don't know, week, two, 3 months. What? Everybody's been doing that, right? Right. I would like to know people familiar with that case, because I could be totally misjudging things. Maybe everybody's super informed and been paying attention to all these cases as they come. I don't think that's the case. I hadn't seen nearly as much attention on that case at all. Like I said, that wasn't even what brought me to that report. Although the executioner's aspect is important too, because they were killing non-white people, so it's all the same thing. Let's see. We will be here on Monday. White woman, I said last week, we will not have any more non-white guests on the program for the remainder of the calendar year, and that might become permanent. I was very excited at the prospect of not having non-white. It might be like a once-in-a-while type thing, like, oh, wow, we're pausing our whites-only whites-only policy. Because, you know, Tupac is not dead and has decided he wants to come to the cows to discuss white supremacy. Or Dr. Horn's new book, would like to talk about that. It's going to come out, so we'll chat to him. But, I mean, yeah, it'll be a rare occurrence, like seeing an albino metaphor. Like, whoa, they actually had a non-white person on the cows. Like, it might end up being that sort of thing. A white woman on the program Monday. Racism and child protection. The black experience of child sexual abuse. Valerie Jackson, she has been on the broadcast before. She is in the United Kingdom. Suspected race soldier. Man, I'm excited to chat it up with her. One, the Jeffrey Epstein case. We haven't really discussed that at all, and I think that's important for so many reasons. Gus T has said for years, white people, white culture, strong component, they do not care about children. Another example right there, Jeffrey Epstein case. Yeah, they've been real aggressive in pursuing justice there. But that's one. Two, we talked about racism and exactly what her book, Child Sexual Abuse, consistently. So I think it's always important to bring that topic up together. That's such a core component, the sexual abuse of black children within the system of racism. And the protests have been global to discuss that as well. So lots to discuss. Since she is in the UK, that means this program will have to be out of our normal time slot. It'll be 3 p.m. Eastern. Monday afternoon, 12 noon Pacific. I think that's 2 p.m. Central afternoon Monday. So if you can tune in, if you're working from home or whatever it is, you can tune in live, ask questions. I think very important topic. As I said, I'm excited to chat about the Jeffrey Epstein case as well. But that'll be this Monday. You can go back in the archives and hear some of her earlier visits. I think she has some constructive information to offer. Should maybe check out her book if you are an attempted parent. Racism and Child Protection has some good info. Anywho, let's see. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. This one broadcast, I do request if we could not use metaphors, and there were some amazing metaphors utilized this week. Wow. I'll start out with one. I wanted to include it in the audio segments, but you can't play everything. So they were talking about football, the essential activity of high school football. And so they were going over the policy, and they even had some white football coaches saying, this is insane that we are playing. And in fact, what was even crazier, they started the report and they said, so I think it's like 30 states are allowing high school football to continue. And they said, within this high-risk activity, and I was thinking high-risk like CTE, you know, brain damage, that's what I was thinking. And they said high-risk activity for COVID-19. And I said, Lord, the lunacy of white supremacy racism. Like, yes, let's go out and get brain damage and the Rona at the same time. Woo. So they get into the report and they have white people saying that we need this, it's important, and yada, 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 and social distance and all the rest. lunacy. So they go to a white person who's being a little more sensible, and he says, we shouldn't be doing this. So then they talk to a white person with a different opinion, and he says, because they were talking about testing, he says, we're doing all this, we're not even testing all these people, we got 100 people on the sideline, and, you know, it's crazy for us to be doing this. And so they go to someone who says, oh, that's nonsense. You know, what is he talking about? He says, it's no difference in risk us having a Friday night football game than these young people going out to a McDonald's on a Friday night. I said, pause right there. Now, I don't say metaphors cannot be used. I don't say that metaphors aren't helpful. What I do say is that white people are very deceptive. That is an illustration. Now, you can just pause right there and examine, because that's exactly what I say all the time. They will take two entities and say, oh, this is exactly the same thing. So a high school football game where you might have, well, they just said it's 100 people on each sideline. That's verbatim in the report. And then it might be 500 people in the stands. It could be 1,000 people, 2,000, 5,000, who knows? So do you think that's the same thing as going to the McDonald's on a Friday night? He said, McDonald's, I'm loving it. So you go to McDonald's where they steer black franchise owners into bad neighborhoods. So you go to the McDonald's. I don't know about in Alabama or Texas or wherever in these places where they have high school football, but here in Washington State, if you go to the McDonald's, the inside is closed. So you'd be in the drive-thru or maybe, I guess, sitting in the parking lot in your vehicle. So do you think going to a McDonald's in the drive-thru in your vehicle or sitting in the parking lot in your vehicle, do you think that's the same thing as being at a football stadium with 500 people or 1,000 people? Just following logic. Now, we had some other amazing metaphors this week. Our president, 4 more years. Now, he's talking about these police shootings. Now, he says, you got to make a split-second decision. You know, it's like having a three-foot putt. Dr. Welsing talks about that golf thing. It's like having a three-foot putt, you know, and you just fluff it, you know. Now, you take that, you go out to golf, and you miss a presumably easy putt. Is that the same thing as shooting Dejon Kizzy 25 times on a bicycle? That's the same thing? As I've said for a long time, race soldiers regularly will take analogies, similes, metaphors. They will do this sort of thing to practice deception. Master deceivers, they say. Victims, myself included, we are still learning. We've been exposed to that type of thing for a long time, and we're still learning. Sometimes we don't have all the logic to articulate our views, so we will substitute a metaphor, analogy of some sort. If we could be precise, direct about what we want to say, that would be super appreciated. In fact, it was said last week that blue uniforms shoot black people. That is a metaphor. It is not possible for any uniform, blue, black, white, any uniform or article of clothing to shoot anyone. That's what I mean about being precise about what we mean to say. People shoot people. Sometimes those people have badges. Often they do not. Speaking of last week, we had Jason Whitlock mentioned on a Cal's broadcast. I do not ever want to hear Jason Whitlock's name again. He is a victim of white supremacy. He's qualified to share any views that he likes about the system of racism. I do not want to hear anything he has to say because I've heard him before and he's often anti-black. That was a conclusion that I had before last week. He was brought up last week just to quote how he name-called another black person. Case in point, I don't ever want to hear Jason Whitlock's name on a Cal's program again. We have a list. So the list is Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, now Jason Whitlock. None of these people, I do not care what you have to say about them. If it's just, oh, I saw a documentary and Al Sharpton was in it, I hadn't seen him in a while. Oh, okay, that's fine. But if it's, I want to offer a critique about, oh, man, I don't like that. You have to find another program. If you have a critique, have something to say about Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, or any references to Jason Whitlock. Much obliged. With that, I think, is that it? Did I get anything else I need to make sure we get in? I will pause for now. What a week it has been. Number again, 720-716-7300. Code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. This is in Yame in Nebraska. I was just calling to give an update on a report. I think my last report was the beginning of June, around the time of the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor protests and all the riots that was going on there. I had called and reported about the riots going on here in Nebraska, in the city that I live, and how the law enforcement agency had some kind of agreement with the so-called black community here, where they were going to sit down and have a session where they could discuss how they were going to hold cops accountable. And there was a video of the police or law enforcement agents and the people in the so-called community doing a keep it shuffle in the park that went national. I actually attended one of these sessions. Actually, there's been three. They've been holding it monthly now. And I've attended each session to see if I could get any kind of constructive information out of it. And it was pretty much as expected. There was a lot of speaking around the issue of racism. And I asked the chief several times about racism in the city. The constructive information I believe I got was he admitted on camera that black people are affected more by police stops. Basically every aspect of law enforcement here. But at the same time, he would not say that it was due to racism unless I asked specifically. The terms he continued to use were bias and prejudice. Even after I called him out, he went right back to using those terms, which I called him out on that again several times. But I noticed that many of the other people were following their lead. And one other thing that I noticed was in the video of them doing the Cupid Shuffle that was shown on national news, there was a black female law enforcement officer in the video. Well, she was present as well. She also happens to be the only black female on the police force, and she's present there. And when faced with questions dealing with racism, there was a lot of racial showcasing going on where they refer to her. I actually was going to send you a video clip. But there was also, I felt like they were trying to set up instances of racial shadow boxing. Because I asked the white male chief a specific question. He would motion to her and have her answer. And he motioned to her about seven times during our exchange. I asked him about specifically if they had a definition for racism and where I could find a definition in their policy. And the place that he gave me did not have a definition for racism. It only stated that officers were encouraged not to show any sentiments that would lead to discrimination based on race or gender or sex or things like that. But there was no definition for race. So when I asked again, the chief wasn't there at the next meeting, but the black female officer was there. But she wasn't the one I asked about it. But when I asked about it, the other white male law enforcement agent, he motioned to her, and she answered on his behalf. But basically what it came down to is that they don't have a definition for racism. And I thought that was quite interesting that the whole purpose of these meetings was to find ways to, quote unquote, hold cops accountable. But how can you hold them accountable if you don't even have a clear definition of the problem that you're going to be holding them accountable for? I'm not sure if I'm going to continue participating in these meetings, but I do find them quite interesting because racism doesn't get overtly spoken about a lot around here. So I was just taking that opportunity to learn as much as I can. I am still learning. But that's pretty much all I have for. Oh, I seen a artwork, supposed to be a dedication to Chadwick Boseman. I suspect it's white people clowning. But it is an animated art piece showing Stan Lee, the creator of Marvel, and holding what is, I guess, supposed to be Chadwick Boseman, except Chadwick Boseman is very small and looks like a child with a beard. And it shows Stan Lee saying, you did good, kid. So I just, you know, I shared it on my Facebook, you know, with the words, the man not, but I also looked at it. It might be some white worship going on there, but overall, I just look at it as, you know, white people using black death to clown even more. But that's all I have to share. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. I'll meet my line.
Much obliged, Inyame in Nebraska. Good to hear from you, sir. I think it's always great when you can get out in those type of settings, if it's worth your time and energy, to be able to question white people, because I think that's something that we all can get better at doing, get more efficient, being able to refine our question-asking techniques. But that is such a standard technique. When a white person is present, especially if they are being accompanied by a victim, and they will be asked a question, and they'll try and pass off and say, oh, we brought, you know, Miss Johnson here or whomever, black male, whatever. Oh, yes, we'll have him give the answer. And I've seen sometimes you have to stop. Be like, I've seen some techniques where people will just say, are you white? And once they get the affirmative, so, okay, well, I need a white person to ask this. Or if you're already talking to the person, Mr. Rogers, I need you to answer this question. You said that you're a white man, so I appreciate getting the honest perspective of a white person and then get your question. And even if you see them doing that repeatedly, I've even said that I've concluded that sometimes that's an act of racism. I found that sometimes white people have a difficult time being honest about racism, and so sometimes as opposed to speaking and revealing truth, they'll just pass off to a victim of racism, and a lot of times we're confused about racism. So if you could, don't pass off the question. Go ahead and answer truthfully. But that is really standard and probably deserves a term of its own, because it's so commonplace where they will just deflect and deflect and deflect. And sometimes they'll pay a victim really good money to deflect to that victim and just have them up there, and we're confused. So, yeah, they're up there saying anything. Bias, prejudice, discrimination, microaggressions, white privilege. We all have bias. BGQ for them, too. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
May I be heard?
Heard both of you.
After you, Grant.
Thank you kindly. I'm going to make it fast. Sadly, the lady from New Orleans that commented on the humidity, she reminded me of my aunt who would make very negative comments about Africa or African things. Rest in peace. But she would have said that. But the humidity does not help cool down places in New Orleans. There's a lot of it is really hot, and there are no trees really, except for when you go to City Park or if you go into the Garden District. I wonder why they named it that. Maybe because rich white people live there. And it has, you know, the famed streets in this area, you know, St. Charles, Magazine Street, so forth, so on, and a lot of cover, a lot of greenery in that area. But I'm from the 7th Ward, and there are trees on what they call the neutral ground, but they're in the middle of the street, you know what I'm saying? So people have to hang out on these neutral grounds in order to get some shade if they want to be outside and close to the house most of the time. Otherwise, it's just the concrete. Well, no, that's a metaphor. It's just houses or buildings. I did notice the, in my opinion, trashy thing that Disney did airing Black Panther. Like, one more time, let's get some, you know, some money since he's dead and everybody will be looking at it, you know. Suspected racists, all of them at Disney. Shame on them for capitalizing on Mr. Bozeman's death. May he rest in peace. I have an opinion as well that I don't know how to feel about these vaccine studies, but I will say working at a pharmaceutical company and seeing that pharmaceutical companies purposely go out and seek non-white people or poor people, whatever those people are, to engage in vaccines and human trials, I don't advise it. They make everybody sign a waiver saying that they won't be held liable if something happens later on after the trial. And then it's really, you have to live a lot of times at the hospital, like for a few weeks or a couple months, depending on the experimentation that they're doing. So you're removed from your family or whatever you got going on. You might get a couple $1,000s, but you've introduced some unknown substance to you in your body. And most of these people aren't in good health, you know. So that's another thing. Like, if you are going to do an efficacy study, you would want to get people that you know, okay, the control is basically they have no health problems. They have, you know, good diets and their, you know, their metabolism is ideal. But they're getting smokers. They're getting people that's overweight. So there's going to be all kind of outcomes coming out of that, plus the people are going to be, again, they're exposing themselves to things they don't know what's going to happen years down the line, the day after the experiment is done, and you sign your rights to sue away or whatever, you know, whatever you could have had a right to do. I just found out about a white lady that has been posing as a black woman at some institutions, and it reminded me about how they said that the statistic is white women take advantage of affirmative action more than anybody. And I said, now, ain't this something? This lady, not only did she practice racism, she did it twice. She practiced racism by being a white woman posing as a black woman, and I know everybody knew better. You know, there's a certain thing called phenotype, and, I mean, she just doesn't have, to me, the phenotype that is even remotely close to an African person or African adjacent, whatever you want to call it. She looks white. I'm going to just say it. She looked white. They knew it, but they said, hey, we get to say we met our requirements for minorities, so go ahead, be black if you want to. We know you're not, and we don't care. You know, very sad and awful for whoever could have gotten that position. And the last thing I was going to say, workplace racism, I've been having trouble at a delivery depot where I've been working with Middle Eastern people, so I asked to be moved, and it was approved. But somewhere along the way, someone else in HR, wherever that is, whoever those people are, lost track of my request, and I was talking to them by email saying, hey, you know, this has already been approved. I don't know how you aren't keeping up. Don't you have a profile on me? And then I said, who am I speaking with? And the person replied, oh, I'm a person in the HR department. I said, you know what? I said, I'm about to go to Twitter and show all these screenshots that I have with you all where you all are not being accountable, where I've reported racism, and it has gone unchecked, unaddressed, and now here I am trying to escape that racism and go to a new depot. You're not obliging, and you're not being direct when I ask who I'm speaking with so I can have a record because of the ambiguity and confusion. I said, is this the reputation you want to have? I'm sure people would want to know. You'll be trending if enough people see it. So then someone with a name in the email me back and said, we got it. Sorry about that. The person didn't know how to look for it, XYZ. I said, okay, well, that's one thing to share with people. Sometimes, you know, don't threaten them or like to sue or, you know, just say, hey, I'll just put it out in the public if that's something you think would actually work. You know, put it on social media. And it, to this time, I'll say this time it worked. It was constructive. And I did mention, you know, I didn't say racism, white supremacy, but I said racism. They know I'm not white. They have my profile picture. So, yeah, they didn't want that. And they went ahead and corrected the problem. And that is all I had to say for now. And y'all have a good night. Be safe.
Much obliged, Irie in Louisiana. Workplace Racism, Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Funny how they will lose paperwork and that sort of thing. Always something that is to our detriment. But good job using your words and asking questions to get the problem solved. I heard several other folks speak up. Thank you for yielding. Some of the other folks that we missed who have not spoken.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. Once again, Gus, thank you for the platform. I really appreciated the commentary of the prior caller. It was some really informative things, and I'd like to add one thing onto that I've noticed about the she spoke about experiments. And what I've noticed in New York City, in the metropolitan area, is that it's still going on, when you ride the trains, they would have advertisements for NYU and for Columbia University for people to come and do experiments with drugs. And they were predominantly drugs, you know, heavy substances like cocaine, marijuana. They would put the indication of what it exactly is, and they stated you'll get money for your, you know, for your time and energy. It was just so hearing what you just spoke about was really interesting. I've never heard anybody sign up for these programs, but I'm so happy that I never was that confused that I ended up signing up for it. Next thing was the actual female white woman that was posing. She was from George Washington State. Her name was Jessica Krug, or K-R-U-G. And she's actually a professor, and she's actually so-called Jewish, and she's a professor of, if I'm correct, her focus was African and Latin American and African American history, early modern world imperialism and colonialism. I think that's just such a disgrace, the fact that she was doing this, because there could have been somebody that was non-white that actually could have deserved that role and had that position and benefited from it. Going back now to the segments, I got to tell you, the Chadwick situation actually, it caused a lot of waves among different people. I don't know if that's a metaphor or not. I don't believe so, but it did cause a lot of people that are around my age. I'm in my 40s. I'm not 43 or that old, but I pretty much just turned there, and it made a lot of non-white males, predominantly black, all look into colon cancer, all try to figure out, you know, what are the symptoms, what are some of the things that would lead to that at such an early age. It really put a lot of non-white males on real notice to be very careful and cautious a little bit more about their habits, including myself. That being said, the segment about the FDI, I found that.
Hold on one second there. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but that's important. Share a little detail. I'm sure we have some other listeners. Maybe you didn't look because that is important, and that even connected to racism, white supremacy. I might be willing to bet a shiny quarter that one might come back to diet, and that idiot that talks about plant-based eating, maybe. But share a little bit. So what? Did you do some research? Colon cancer. What did you learn?
Basically, colon cancer, a lot of early signs are it does go back to diet. Let's start with that first. And one of the things that is imperative to really stay away from is heavy usage of alcohol. It deteriorates the colon and starts to really destroy your intestines. That was the big thing that I got out of it. The other things were not really poignant as that, but the symptoms obviously were very important. The constipation, the diarrhea, and bloody quote unquote stools. And I think that even if you don't drink a lot, if you're eating foods that cause the constipation, diarrhea, and anything of that nature, you should be very cautious about what you're consuming there. And that should cause you to take a step back and go, I have to really analyze my diet. What am I consuming that's causing me to have issues with my bowel movement? Because that's really one of the signs right there is a very important one. It's a very important one. And that's what the major thing I got from it. But alcohol was a very, very important one. It was like literally top of the list when it came to colon cancer. And red meat, organ meat, refined flour, sugary drinks, all these things cause issues. And they stated within the same research that on the other side, green leafy vegetables, dark yellow vegetables, whole grains. I was surprised to see coffee. I don't drink coffee, but I was surprised to see that. Fruit juice appeared to reduce inflammation. And I think when they say fruit juice, I don't think they mean the type of stuff you get from Snapple. I'm pretty sure they're meaning something that you get your own blender and you make your own fruit juice. I'm pretty sure that that's what they're inferring to. But that's the chunk of everything that I've researched. And also smoking, of course. Those are some things that I gathered from the research that I did in regards to colon cancer. And I passed a lot of this information on to the other non-white males that are, they're being careful and they're being cautious. Moving on, the John Thompson situation, I feel that if anybody has the time, Allen Iverson spoke in the segment that you put together. And I think it's important if people have the time to go and check out Allen Iverson's documentary. And this lets you know that, even if you're a star athlete, Allen Iverson was the star athlete in the country at the time. And what happened to him was just, it was disgusting. I'm not going to get into details in it. I suggest people watch it. You will get constructive information from it. And yes, John Thompson will be in it, and there will be discussions about what took place with him and his mother a little bit more in depth. And the other aspect, for myself, downtown Brooklyn, they had another bike riding protest. And the more I see these protests, the more I believe that they're just so, it's just a waste of time. And I'm not trying to belittle VGQ to anybody that's non-white that's going out there and doing what they feel is constructive. I'm not going to get in the way or interfere with that. But I've done it, and I have to tell you, after doing it the first time, I spoke about it on the cows, I noticed something. There were more white people there than non-white, And even though the protest is about so-called Black Lives Matter, not one white person would even look me in the eye and go, hey, how are you doing? How are you feeling during all this madness going on with so many people that look like you? Not one white person even greeted me. And I'm talking, I'm like probably one of 10 black people in a crowd of 400, 300. And I said to myself, I'll never do this again. And I never will. So I've been seeing these protests weekly in downtown Brooklyn, all over the city, but it's predominantly in downtown Brooklyn. The segue about that so-called white vigilante, the racist lunatic shooting people in Wisconsin, it was very deceptive because she stated that he was picked up in a neighboring neighborhood, and that is not the case. Sorry, that is not the case. He actually was coming from Ohio. He was coming from, if I remember correctly, Chicago or Ohio, something to that degree. He did not come from that state, so it wasn't a neighboring community. And he slept, went to bed, and woke up, and then they came and arrested him. And the FBI collapsing, I could speak about that later on. I think that was a great playback, by the way. That's all I have to say. I will mute my line. Peace.
That does a lot of talking about whole foods, plant-based eating, I think is also known for saying sobriety would be best. Chadwick Boseman, try to learn what we can from very, very tragic passing, man. Other folks that we've missed totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Hello? We have other folks? Oh, okay. Yes,
can
sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Mo from Dallas. Breonna Taylor's ex being offered to... greetings, Gus. My apologies. Greetings, callers and listeners. I will do my best to not use metaphors and be clear in my views on the segments presented. Breonna Taylor's ex being offered a deal to slander her name or take 10 years. That's an example of black male privilege. You know, choose your oppression. It's either like the ultimatum is either, be subjugated in greater confinement or be subjugated out of greater confinement. There was no, there is no option for him in which side he would have chosen, you know, because if he would have slandered her, he would have been subject to being persecuted outside. You know, he would have been called, a low life and all of these things and possibly been in danger outside by the Breonna Taylor supporters and whatnot. And if he, you know, chose to stay in the system, he's subject to any and all persecution by suspected racists. So that's... those are your options, in a system of white supremacy. Either make us appease us, or we'll throw you to the wolves, or stay in here and you can get eaten by these wolves. Sorry for the euphemism. No accountability for the people inside of the institution when it came to Curtis Flower. I believe, a lot of times the victims of racism, in institutions, when these individuals, you know, do 30, 40 years and kind of age out of their usefulness in the institution, we see we made a mistake. We gonna let him go now. And I've read a couple of articles about this. A lot of times these people, while they're in greater confinement, they become sickly You know, it's expensive to care for them, and that leads to a lot of the release of these innocent people. You know, and they understand, or they suddenly understand. You know, well, the witnesses we had were unreliable, and blah blah blah. You know, it's really wild. Because it's as if these are anomalies, and it's very common for innocent people to be released after 20 something years and a my bad and a pat on the back, you know, good luck, and even getting out, a lot of these victims still are looked at as criminals, even though they have, you know, articles saying that they did nothing wrong. The cow in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So what the caller was saying, he was an Illinois native. I'm not sure of the city, but he did travel across state lines. He was 17, in the possession of a firearm. He shot three people, murdered two, and his mother drove him. That's like four felonies, like. And he's looking as a hero. That's just like how that behavior is promoted. When he was noticed to be a shooter, I think the segment said that armored cars drove by him, you know. They knew he wasn't, or they felt as if he wasn't a threat to them. And he had time to call his mom, get picked up, get his affairs in order, take a shower, maybe get some Burger King, who knows. The BIE and white supremacists are classified in the same group, even though that BIE, the movement, there is no black movement. I believe that is, again, a blatant act of white supremacy, because any person, any victim of racism that speaks against racism can be labeled a BIE member, but they, for some reason, they just can't put a finger or can't get a active read on who are white supremacists, you know. I thought that was very interesting. Elizabeth Newman sounds like a disgruntled employee for knowing the statistics, pointing out that most of the arrests and aggression are from the far right. I'm also not in support of the use of the terms left wing and right wing. It's all white supremacy, and I believe that that statement, calling her a disgruntled employee, was kind of like a dog whistle or
30 seconds
warning. Yes, sir. Well, I will end with, you mentioned Jeffrey Epstein, so that made me think of his funeral. I found out today is the anniversary of his funeral. I didn't know when it was, but I thought that was very interesting. Thank you, Amy Malone.
Wow. I did not know that information either, still learning. But, wow, we will be talking more about Mr. Epstein on Monday, because that's a really important case that I don't really think we've spent too much time discussing, and then the updates and all the rest of it. So it will be important to get some of that detail in a correct context this Monday. Thrown to the wolves is a metaphor as well. Other folks that we have missed totally, the number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks, if we missed you totally, proceed.
Hello. I just wanted to say real quick, the town he came from is Antioch, Illinois. It's west of, like, Zion, Illinois. I believe it's in Will County. And it's my belief it's a sundown town because when I lived in Illinois, we went to a place out there where a white lady goes around collecting, like, artifacts and stuff. And then she sells them, you know, at her house. It's a sprawling estate. But on the way there, it was nothing but Blue Lives Matter signs, Trump, Pence signs, and, you know, like, it was nuts when the first time he was running for office. So that was what I saw when I was up there last. And that's all I want to say. That's where he went home to.
Obliged, Irie. I checked James Lowen's Sundown Towns. We read that in the book club as well. I checked, and I didn't see that town mentioned in the book because I had the same thought process, like, particularly because he said a lot of those northern states like Illinois, you did have a lot of black people migrate to cities like Chicago, but white people did not allow black people to just move willy-nilly throughout states like Illinois and Michigan and what have you. They're in very strategic locations. So places like Antioch and Anna, places like that, no Negroes. But I was thinking that exactly. I just didn't see the town mentioned specifically in the book and didn't get to do any more digging. But I am not stunned to hear that at all about little Kyle Rittenhouse. Race soldier. Other folks that we missed, we have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast, so no, you know, lollygagging. Other folks that we missed, totally proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, so the callers. Chadwick Boseman. John Thompson, Cliff Robinson. I always heard that's coming 3 years on. That was a saying my grandmother used to use, and it was like three. But we started the year with Kobe, we lost Bill Withers, Dr. Africa, Pop Smoke, Rocky Johnson, black wrestler back then, and that was huge when I was young. Roger Mayweather. Yeah, it's a few this year. But on the other side of that, we have white people in pickup trucks shooting at each other. And, I mean, it's a Rittenhouse and Michael Reinhold. I mean, you know, you can't ask for more than that. I mean, white-on-white crime, I'm all with it. What should be done with white people? You know, this is amazing. And we didn't even get into the thick of the elections yet. It's just the beginning. It's from the Washington Post. So last time I did something for the Daily News, it didn't go too well. But Akon City, he's calling it Akonda. I thought Chadwick Boseman. $6 billion city proposed to be built by the rapper singer Akon. And he's trying to get black people to invest in this. I would just say look up the SoFi Stadium, S-O-F-I Stadium, the building in Los Angeles. So far, they spent $5.8 billion to build the stadium. If you had a $6 billion city, I don't know. Hurricane season, over my lifetime, they had climate change, they used global warming. When I was real young, they used to call it the ozone layer depletion. Way back, they started with sustainable development. The solution to all these problems is always to reduce the population and reduce the carbon emission. What people have a carbon base, you know, we call it melanin. But all this starts from the book in 1788. It's called The Essay on the Principles of Population, written by a gentleman by the name of Malthus. I forget his first name, but they call it the Malthusian catastrophe. And this is where all of this, the creation of these reasons to reduce the population start coming right after this. It's been, I mean, they've been doing this for years. So Adolph Rupp, that was Pat Rowley's coach in college. Pat Rowley is a white person. I think most people would not think is a white supremacist. They got a movie called Glory Road about his undefeated Kentucky Wildcats losing to the all-black starting five from Western Texas. And that was like the game that after that all the white team started recruiting black players. I forget what year it is, but it's a movie about it. The excessive shooting of unarmed males, seven shots in the back. No, that's excessive. You said 20-plus times. I didn't even notice. So you put that story out, and I'm usually up on this stuff. So shot over 20 times. Are these passion murders or premeditated murders? Because they can't be provocation murders. That's what police fall under, saying that their murders are justified because of provocation. One shot is provocation, you know, 20. Remember the couple, Gus, in Ohio? I think they were being pulled over and their car backfired and the cops just unloaded hundreds of rounds. One cop jumped on the hood of the car, unloaded, reloaded. I mean, that's excessive. That's premeditation to me. It's not provocation. Breonna Taylor, I think the reason this case has not moved forward and the reason the cops have not been charged is because of her involvement in illicit activity. In 2016, she had a rental car with a dead body in it that she said was that happened to be one of her boyfriend's associates at the time. And there's a lot of stuff when you look up this case. They have a camera outside her house, seeing people go in and out 20 times. I think there's a lot more to the story. I wouldn't be surprised if white supremacists just wait and then they put out all this information. And, you know, that's how they usually do things. Lastly, the FBI, they put out a report in 2006 titled White Supremacist Infiltration of Law Enforcement. Anytime I hear the FBI, it's like, come on, y'all knew this. Y'all knew about the white supremacists in law enforcement. Forget about the groups that the law enforcement is supposed to arrest. Y'all have a report on them in law enforcement, and it's massive. The black identity extremists, in my opinion, are all these white people flying around the country to protest, chanting Black Lives Matter. Those are white identity extremists. We had a teacher this week who was black, Rachel Dorsal. I think that Trump should invoke the HRAP Brown laws on these protesters. I'm with my mind thinking.
Timothy Russell, Melissa Williams. Timothy Russell, Melissa Williams. Those are the names of the two black people, black male, black female, unarmed, who were shot and killed in Cleveland. 137 shots, and the officer did indeed jump on the vehicle. I did remember that because that was right about the time the Cleveland Police Department got one of those FBI mandates, whatever that means, if it's worse than anything, consent decree for that sort of misconduct. I don't even think that incident was included. I think they had already been indicted for misconduct when that incident. That was just kind of like the metaphor, the icing on the cake, if you will. Anywho, other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with the segment where the black male, I did not hear about that case, but I noticed the wording. She said, I think a minimum. She said, I don't know if it was 12 or, and then she went to 20, and then she used the word excess, I believe. I'm like, man, she used the word minimum, like it was 3 or 2. I don't know, just the way that I heard it, because that's not happening to everybody. Like, that's mainly happening to black people, black males. So, you know, I had noticed that, piecing together words like that. Here locally, there was some, see, because school just started back the semester for both public schools and the University of Florida. So they have this COVID-19 database. They call it a dashboard. And on the first day, they ran a report that Lake Forest is a elementary school over on the east side of town where mostly black residents, a residential area. They were very specific. They said one student tested positive, and 6 students had to be quarantined along with the teacher. So I looked up, and then it was 4 other people at different schools that tested positive also, but they didn't run a story on those. And those schools are on the areas where white people are mainly. So it seemed like in that instance, racism is being practiced. And it looks like 1 middle school and no high schools. So I wanted to share that. And there was another story where they said that they were doing a protest over in Williston, a town near where I'm at. And they had a black male on there, and the term I guess they used was the inequality in how they report stories. And I guess they said six people were shot because they said it started as a protest and then it turned into a block party. Using that word again, block party. And white people were having a so-called block party last week, where people got shot. It was the debauchery going on and everything, but they didn't run the story on that. So they would, the people were trying to act like they didn't know what the guy was saying. So definitely more racism being practiced. And as far as the protests in general, like I do agree, I think white people are using that to orchestrate more confusion. Because I've seen where they're calling a bunch of people walking down in a certain direction with vests and giant rifles. They use the term Patriots, and the guy actually had on a Patriots jersey, the NFL jersey. So they're not using the word peaceful protest with them. They use the term Patriot. So I just wanted to share those things, and that's all I have to say right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Great observation about the coronavirus reports in Florida. I mean, why not just, you know, give all the information? This is the information that we have for all of the schools. Why would it just be focused on this one school? The Negroes are the contagion. Why not just give all the information? So you say, hey, this is the job that we're doing to keep all of the children in the Sunshine State safe. Excellent observation, just checking out what they are, especially when the information is right there. You can just go on with the dashboard or whatever it is and see, you know, what it looks like in your particular area. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
We at least had a couple folks say that they had not heard about this case. Dijon Kizzy, black male, shot, we don't know, 20, could have been 30, who knows, many times. Black male privilege for Dijon Kizzy. Other folks, if you heard about that case or if this was your first time hearing about that case, again, don't be a spectator. If we have any other folks with the school, because the school situation has been crazy this week as well, and meaning lots of reports of white debauchery, where white people have come back and partied. I've heard that at numerous campuses in Georgia. The University of South Carolina Gamecocks, that is the official label for the school, they reported all of these, like hundreds and hundreds of cases. And they said a major part of it, white fraternity members, white sorority members, having big parties, underage drinking, I am sure, and all of this hanging out, doing all the rest of it, and it, school just started. They just had 1 week of school. We haven't even got to Labor Day yet. And anywho, if you have commentary, if we missed you totally, don't wait till the end. Star 6-1. If you have extra thoughts, yes, proceed.
Good evening, everyone. Yeah, I just wanted to say I did hear about that gentleman in I think that was California. I think I heard about it through Tariq Nasheed's Twitter page, because I think they also had protests. But when I heard about the incident, I did not read the article, because it came to a point where it's like it's so many of these incidents where I don't really read all of them sometimes, but I'm familiar with them. I know there's a protest, but I didn't know how much time he was shot. That's excessive. That's a lot. Yeah, I just want to comment a little bit about a little VGQ right now about speaking to non-white people and white people about the system of racism and white supremacy, and I find it tiring speaking to both groups. At times, I find that when I speak to white people about racism and white supremacy, I get victims protecting white people and also other white people, you know, saying, you know, this white person is a good white person and they're not racist, and that whole language, and it becomes very tiring, because sometimes you feel like you're convincing people of something. Yeah, and that's all I have to say. Thanks for letting me share.
Excuse me, Gus.
Thank you for sharing, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to a little bit of what the prior caller was sharing. I think that we all still work with that. I don't think that's anything, you know, I got to tell you, that's something that's everybody, I believe, has a quote-unquote trigger, something that may lead to a conversation with a non-white person that's non-constructive. And I think we're all working on maintaining that, too. And that's essentially, VGQ. So it's good to hear that we're all in that same process and working towards that. With that said, I'll move my line.
Much obliged, sir. Let's see. Other folks, we have about 10 minutes left in the broadcast, so no waiting until the very last second. If you think you have additional comments to share, get your hand up. Let's see. Other folks dialed in that we missed. Proceed.
Greetings.
Retired firefighter? Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I would just like to give some recognition to the Coach Thompson, Georgetown University. Am I correct with his last name?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, yes. On his life's work, utilizing the platform that he created and used it to what it's supposed to be used for, and in the light of the pioneers before him, such as Eddie Robinson and people like that, and Alonzo Jake Gaither at Florida A&M. And matter of fact, you know, for the most part, all of those non-white black male coaches who were at those historical black colleges before the global system of white supremacy started focusing directly on recruiting black males in that billion-dollar industry. It makes it very difficult for the Thompsons to maximize those platforms that would send black males back into an environment. I would suspect very strongly that there were more teachers, black male teachers, in the public school system back when I was growing up than what it is now. And that is one of the reasons why, with this maximum recruiting effort that starts with a black male when he's 5 years old, and the only ambition is to play professional sports, and almost literally nothing else of any type of ambition or interest out of those young people. And Mr. Thompson certainly placed a lot of options and stayed with those young people in the aftermath of their college career. And plus, it is identified by the high graduation rate, which is what you're supposed to be going to college for in the first place. So I just wanted to give some gratitude towards that. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Peace.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Were there other folks who had comments that they wanted to get in our last few minutes while we are on?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York?
Yes, I wanted to say something about school. My children have been doing online school for the last, you know, since school started like 3 weeks ago. And, you know, other than slowing down my Wi-Fi, that's been okay. Now, they've been told that they are not going back to official school until January. What I'm hearing here in the city amongst the public schools is the teachers are threatening to strike because de Blasio said school is opening, and principals have another union. They're threatening to strike. New York isn't equipped for homeschooling. Also, a huge amount of the budgets for all major cities come from the schooling budget. And they can't get the budget unless they have physical students in the building. So I know that's also at play in all of this as well. So in one breath, he's telling us, send your kids back to school. But then in the next breath, he gives another press conference and says, we're not opening restaurants until 2021. So we still can't eat inside of a restaurant, but you want us to send our kids to school? Like, where does that make sense at? The alternative to dining in New York is people eat outside on the sidewalk. I live in Harlem. So yesterday, on Lenox Ave, I took my daughter to the eye doctor. And Lenox Ave, they have all these restaurants with the whole sidewalk out in the seats. People asking people to change while they're eating. This is not the right place for this. It's just... Yeah, so I'll be my wife. Thank you. But one more thing, Gus. I believe the documentary, someone mentioned the Allen Iverson documentary, always brings back to the point where he got the realization of the situation he was in. He said, man, that judge got a lot of power. And he realized it.
Yeah, that is a very solid documentary on white supremacy racism, no crossover. Allen Iverson is, you know, Hall of Famer and a big star and everything. So I was thinking there actually are multiple documentaries on Allen Iverson. So the one that I was thinking of that I've seen, it features that segment. It's about just the brawl that happened while he was a student in high school in Virginia. I don't believe John Thompson is in there. He might be at the end, but I'm actually thinking I'm not sure that he's actually in that film. It might be just a tad at the end, and because mostly it's just about that brawl that happened and him having to go to jail and blah, 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 and all the rest of it. But, yeah, there are multiple. They all deal with racism in some way, but that one I think is No Crossover is the title of it. But there are multiple, and I'm sure John Thompson either talked about or has a little cameo in a number of them. He certainly talked about at the end of that one as the conclusion of, whoopee, it's not just going to be another black male in jail, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say. Any other comments, observations folks have before we conclude?
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago, is that? No?
Thank you.
Mo in Dallas, sorry.
Yes, sir. Just speaking to the executioners, the California police gang, I read in the L.A. Times that there was an officer named, I want to say his name is Ostroberto Gonzalez, who anonymously reported the assault of another colleague. And a few days later, he received a threatening text message. And I believe that either implies that these the executioners have either they either have supporters or members that have access to anonymous files. Also, they have inking parties after initiation. And the tattoo is of a Nazi skeleton wearing a skeleton wearing a Nazi helmet and carrying an AK-47. That's a part of initiation after you do whatever's required to get initiated into the gang. Thank you. I need my line.
Believe number one, much obliged, Mo in Dallas. I believe number one, Dr. Welsing also talked about tattoos and individuals who are melanin deficient doing things like getting tattoos and or ingesting coffee, dark liquids, that type of thing. But I believe a part of you get this ink, get something to darken your skin after you kill somebody. I think that's what the report was suggesting, that, you know, you want to go out and see if you can kill somebody to get inked. It seemed like from the report, killing black, that maybe that explains a part of the passion, the zeal that would produce 24, 30 shots being fired at Dijon Kizzy. Maybe that's incorrect, but it seemed like that's what the report was suggesting. You kill somebody, cat him up, get inked. The executioners do more research. Any other comments before we conclude? Assume folks are all satisfied.
Gus, I have a question.
On Monday, Valerie Jackson, white woman, she'll be joining us live from the UK. She has been a guest on the program previously, and I thought she had reasonably solid information. Didn't have to do a lot of brawling and quarreling to get constructive information. She admitted to practicing racism, white supremacy. So, I mean, we'll all have be alert for her doing just that, folks that are listening live anyway. But that should be Monday, and it will be early. 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Her book, again, is Racism and Child Protection. She's twice in the archives. We talked about Jimmy Savile and some of the other white child rapists, but we'll discuss the protests, probably what's happening with the Rona. I saw, to what Thomas in New York was saying, I saw some of the information. I don't have children, but I have been, you know, trying to just be mindful. The teachers in New York, where they were going to go on strike because they were saying this is ridiculous and we don't have an adequate timetable or adequate details about what's the protocol to make sure that we're safe and the students are safe and everything else and all the rest. They were talking seriously about going on strike. And I think they, unless I am misinformed, I think they had pushed the date back a little bit to give more time to kind of get an adequate plan together and all the rest of it. But I mean, wow. Talk about chaos and confusion. Thomas in New York said his offspring said they're not, I guess, going to be doing the in-person stuff until, like, at least next year, all the virtual learning until at least the end of the year. I guess at minimum that should be a little bit safer than going to school, and who knows what they're doing, if they're going to be taking it serious or acting a fool once you get there. So, man, parents, be as mindful, be as dutiful as you can. Wow, lots and lots to process through this crazy year. So we'll be here Monday. Valerie Jackson, White Woman, UK, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Our new book, we finished White Dog on Thursday. What a read. Absolutely spectacular. In my top 10, right there with Medical Apartheid, for totally different reasons, like I said, begrudgingly, because it's not even a well-written book, in my opinion. But Isabel Wilkerson, she already has a book in the top 10, The Warmth of Other Suns. I am not excited, making sure I get that stated repeatedly before we start. I am not excited about this book. I do not, you know, am not, my thinking is not, ooh-wee. The lovely Isabel Wilkerson, she already has one book that was extraordinary. This might be another. No, that's not Gus's thinking at all. I would say I am intrigued. It's a new book. It's about racism. Discussion of Nazi Germany. But no, I would not say I'm really excited that I think this is going to be a spectacular book. It's brand new. Like, I think it just was published a few days ago. So, you know, hot off the presses, the metaphor they use. We can invoke that one. We will start on Thursday. I'm not sure, like, you know, if you want a hard copy to follow along, I would normally say this would probably be an easy one because she's a best-selling author and she's published for the New York Times, and I suspect this would probably be an easy book, but with the Rona and everything, the library here is now open. So that's what I mean. Maybe you can go to your library and get things. Maybe you can't. If you can, you could probably get this book. You are notified. We'll start Thursday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Cased Isabel Wilkerson. With that, much obliged to everyone tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. We'll be back in about, or I guess less than 48 hours. I guess this is a holiday weekend, so it's like especially important. And then with what we heard, the recommendation, given what we learned, the passing of the great Chadwick Boseman, sobriety would be best for many, many reasons under the system of white supremacy. We need our brain computers, colon health, overall health and well-being. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle. I would still, folks are getting shot 20 times on a bicycle. I would maybe stay in the house. Kyle Rittenhouse, I mean, the 17-year-olds are a problem. Killers. If you got to go out, I would definitely be alert, mindful, really pay attention. If it looks like a white person, really anybody, but especially a white person, they're being loud and hostile, looks like they're trying to escalate something, it is no time to save face, exit.
That is what it is all about. Exit. No need to take risks in 2020. Long, long list of grieving losses. Not trying to add to that list. Let's get out of here. You should be thinking that a lot of these white people who are being loud and hostile in public are probably armed. Anywho, going out, we are sober. We are buckled. This is an essential trip, not for a high school football game. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Number one, need all of our attention. Be paying attention to what's happening around us. Number two, we are trying to minimize contact with race soldiers as best we can, just even the little things. Being buckled up, not on the cell phone. Being sober. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy, no name calling. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.